go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Minute past the hour, and we have made it to the end of the week. This is Friday on the Front Porch on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our little home amongst the millions of other sites on the interweb cubes. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, and that's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room. Folks already beginning to filter in. We don't have, you know, out on the interweb tubes, there's no lights you can blink to make sure that everybody comes into the theater. But this isn't a theater anyway. This is a front porch. So there's moseying going on. Mosey on up to the front porch. Grab yourself a swig out of that crockery jug over there with the corn cob stopper in the top. Careful, though. It's about 160 proof this last run. It's a mite strong, you might say. Or there's sweet tea, lemonade, ice-cold long-neck beer in the zinc-galvanized tub with ice all the way up to the bottle caps and a little rock salt sprinkled on the ice just to get it extra, extra cold. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is a little exercise that we've been working at for a lot of years now that we call Conversation Radio. It's an attempt to actually have dialogue and discussion. And we have a special lot of fun on Fridays because since it is Friday on the front porch and there's just a whole bunch of moseying going on, we get our Friday on the front porch gang together. Chat room moderator and Horn Malloy Skype group moderator Sparky is in the chat room now, and we'll be cranking up the Friday on the front porch chat here in the not too distant future. I was a little late in turning on the Skype. Sorry. But we'll get there. We'll get there. We are, of course, this little discussion, this little community conversation happens because y'all make it happen. You pay the bills. And it is deeply inspiring to know that you do find such value in this effort. This has been a deeply stressful week. A bunch of bills have been paid that have made it more certain that we will at least see the 8th anniversary of the Horn come October 24th. That's the 8th anniversary of this incarnation. We're actually, the idea is 10 years old. I started out, came back to radio in 2003 filling in for Dr. Bill O'Brien. Then by 2004 we had gone to our own program. And on October the 24th, 2005, we initiated this internet-only edition. So it was considerably disturbing to contemplate the idea of not even of being this close to our anniversary and not making it to that date. But we will make it, thanks to you, and thanks to your kind generosity in making sure that we were able to take care of a bunch of stuff that absolutely had to be taken care of. We are within within $100, thanks to Paul from Parts Unknown. We are within $100 of matching the $1,000 contribution that came in, and we do need to continue the fundraising. I'm not going to say that, however. I'm going to let somebody else say it for us. I got a note in. It was Tuesday when we had a note from our buddy Harry in Baltimore. who said things I would never dare say. And in fact, when people among other things, there were responses to Harry of things like standing ovation for what Harry had said. And he followed up after that. Harry followed up with as follows. He warns that this is a potentially presumptuous message from me to the rest of the Horn family commune. I read through it. I don't find it presumptuous at all. I just find it to be freighted with the kind of candor that we all recognize in one another and that we bring to this discussion, this dialogue. Harry writes, when I downloaded and then listened recently... Sorry, I'm also fooling with Skype over here. Someday we'll have a staff. When I downloaded and then listened recently to the podcast of your program of Tuesday, September 24th, I was both profoundly flattered and honored that you read parts of my email to the rest of the Horn family commune. This was my email in response to your very troubling announcement on Monday the night before. Monday was the day of your grave announcement about the serious financial difficulties faced by the Horn and your possible plans to terminate your nightly program on September 28th. Although I now know from having listened to more recent podcasts, much to my relief and with the deepest gratitude, that some wonderful people, including the anonymous $1,000 donor, have made sufficient donations to the Horn, that you are feeling quite optimistic about continuing your nightly program into the foreseeable future, and at least through the anniversary date in October, I write once again this week, after not being in communication, for several reasons. I write again, despite the possibility that this second email will possibly be perceived by the Horn family commune as selfish, presumptuous, and perhaps even unreasonable, as I said in my earlier email, the one you read on Tuesday night, I have not found any news or social issue-focused radio or TV programs that are as intellectually satisfying and as emotionally engaging as your nightly program. Indeed, your podcasts, since I have not lately even had access to a reliable internet signal, have kept me sane and alive through some of the darker hours of my recent existence. Although I emphasized in my earlier email your extraordinary talent as an alternative radio host and journalist, and your matchless persistence, this is where I get uncomfortable reading this stuff. Because, I just do. Your matchless persistence in pursuing a new and different kind of radio programming, despite all of the factors that might argue against such a venture, I failed to mention one other reason why I think your program deserves the label unique among radio programs. And that reason is your almost infinite capacity for empathy, both with respect to each of your diverse callers and also with respect to your larger listening audience, i.e. the Horn family commune, as a whole. As a few of the Horn family commune might possibly recall, I sent you an email several months ago, and I remember it, that mentioned a recently published book by a British professor of developmental psychopathology at Cambridge University. That researcher had asserted in a 2011 book that the human capacity for empathy is the, quote, most valuable resource in our world. For the scholars in the Horn family commune, the exact citation is Baron Cohen, Simon, The Science of Evil on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty, Basic Books, 2011, page 153. Although many may quibble with the professor's assessment, or may point out that the person making that assertion is a specialist in the field of autism, who would naturally be more focused than others on the range of degrees of empathy found in human beings, I feel compelled, nevertheless, to express my view that your indefatigable empathy is a major, if not the key, feature of your interactive radio program that makes it, in fact, unique in the American media landscape right now. And so I write to ask that if other people in the Horn family commune also value the extraordinary empathy that you bring to your program every night, that we, that is the Horn family commune, do our utmost to build up as large a financial surplus for your programming as the Horn family commune can possibly afford. Please note that I said above that my email was selfish, and I made that assertion because As you know, my own finances are in a completely abysmal condition. So I've been in no position to donate any money to the Horn for the entire past year. And that inability therefore causes me to worry that this present email is indeed a quite presumptuous one. But you know how I've been faring over the past year. The major reason that I moved out of Washington, D.C. after 24 years of residence in that city was because of the almost complete collapse of my finances in the fall of 2012. Many people in this country, I'll add editorially, have experienced similar collapse. And so there is empathy, one would presume, all over the place for such a circumstance. Harry continues, and in January 2013 I moved, somewhat abruptly, to Baltimore, both because the cost of living is, relatively speaking, so much cheaper here than in Washington, D.C., and also because I had thought that I had a better chance, having already been inducted into the Maryland Bar 15 years ago, to use, I am dearly hoping, in a constructively and benign fashion, the two law licenses, both D.C. and Maryland, that this unfathomable universe of ours decided to allow me to have. I say allow because I found my specific law school experience and the training I received there to be intellectually superficial, sometimes cruel and insensitive, and almost totally devoid of any vision of lawyer as societal healer. That I have received any law licenses at all to try to use on behalf of good and constructive causes is, in my view, a complete cosmic accident and not in any way inevitable or predictable. And I will say, interjecting, I will say that what Harry describes as the difficulty of trying to use a law degree for good is not something that is unique to Harry. You'd be surprised the number of people who go through 3 years of, and it is, it's hell. It's just a 3 years of just neurotic, sophistic mess. And get to the end of law school, pass the bar, go out into practice, and a couple of years later realize that they have turned into someone that they do not wish to be. If there is any group of people you do not want to hang out with, it's a bunch of first-year law students. Quite possibly, and I would say there are others, but I would say first-year law students are probably among the most obnoxious, let's just say that, students on planet Earth. Unless maybe it's people studying to be Baptist ministers or something. Because all they can talk about is, ooh, he has a duty to do this, and she has that right, and people become these little bundles of rights and duties, instead of, as Harry notes, looking at it as a matter of trying to become a societal healer. Corporations don't want societal healing. And the expense of law school is almost guaranteed. It's designed, in fact, to make sure that not very many people rush out into the world hoping to do good, but rather have to go into immediate debt service so that they wind up working for some godforsaken corporation or some law firm that defends them and taking part in that pyramid scheme. Yes, law firms are pyramid schemes. At least the big ones on the defense side of things, where little first or second year law students carry briefcases for 5 years for some guy who's billing himself at $1,500 an hour while the first and second year law students are doing all the work. You get the idea. But anyway, Harry had said, Harry continues, I say allow because I found my specific law school experience, you know, intellectually superficial, sometimes cruel and insensitive, all of which is true. But he says, regardless of my own personal setbacks, worldly failures, and unlucky family circumstances, I myself would like to continue to live in a universe where there is, at the least, a Bob Kincaid program every weekday night. Because although I may be struggling mightily, and often failing, to find my own professional and personal satisfactions, I believe that it is vital that the universe, so to speak, allow you, Bob Kincaid, to continue your professionally innovative, creatively civic-minded, and socially healing radio programming. You have no idea how humbling it is to read something like this. Which, of course, is kind of egotistical for me to even say, so I apologize. Harry continues, "So I know I am being presumptuous when I ask this of the entire Horn Family Commune, but I have decided to take the risk and ask it anyway. That is, I am asking that you please do what you can, no matter how small each individual contribution of yours might be, and no matter how infrequently you are able to contribute anything, please help Bob in any way you can to continue to create his unique form of educational, inspiring programming every weekday night. I ask this because I would like Bob to be able to continue to do his part to contribute to the healing of our society and of our world, a North American or Western society in particular, that many of us in the Horn Family Commune know to be almost completely broken and often destructive to its own members. Moreover, please consider this. Bob has continued to stream his show every weekday night, despite, unbelievably enough, a personal life that is also somewhat broken. I know in my heart that if I owned a home, and that a single storm last summer grievously damaged my roof and also completely killed off some of my major home appliances, such as a refrigerator, washer, dryer, so that I could not even do laundry in my own house, I would not, myself, have the mental stamina to focus every day on creative, innovative, and caller-centered radio programming. Most weekday nights, I and other listeners undoubtedly listen to Bob and inadvertently assume that his quality of life is generally rock-solid and adequately comfortable. But I know now that this may not be true, and thus I find Bob's emotional and cognitive stamina to be truly astounding. And so, if only to honor Bob's extraordinary dedication and complete devotion to the Horn Family Commune, I would ask of you that you give to the Horn as much money or other things as you can, either right now or in future weeks, so that we can all feel more assured that the Bob Kincaid program will continue to enrich our lives, and maybe, just maybe, will also contribute to healing this painfully dysfunctional and sometimes destructive society and larger world of ours. Thank you for your understanding. With warmest regards to all of the Horn Family Commune, both veteran callers and new listeners, signed, Harry." The only folks here right now are Ferg and me. Agnes is off over a couple of counties away, as are my daughters. And when this came in, I didn't really have a... I would far rather that somebody else had read this than me. Because I feel really, really self-conscious about such glowing words. Because it's you that makes this all worthwhile. And I'm not talking about financially. I'm talking about the outreach and the conversation that goes back and forth between us that wouldn't be happening otherwise. You make this worthwhile. By a long shot. I followed up on Harry's email simply by thanking him for writing what he did. And he responded, "I am not the kind of person who has ever been good at or interested in providing opportunistic flattery or other kinds of brown-nosing behavior. So please know that my words accurately reflect my perceptions of you from three sources: your programs over the past year, the emails that you and I have personally exchanged, and our person-to-person meeting way back in the early summer of 2012 in the middle of Lafayette Park." And Harry says, "Yes, I intended for someone to pick up on my initial mention of you having to use a laundromat. And I was delighted that Kate picked up on it and tried to carry it further. But I decided that the home life issues were definitely worth announcing again to the entire Horn Family Commune. I find that others imagine that talented people," he says parenthetically, "like you," I can barely juggle, "have all parts of their life fully together. Often, however, that is not true at all. So at least to me, it is important that the Horn Family Commune continue to be aware of how much day-to-day discomfort you and your family are enduring in your damaged house while you try to keep your unique radio program on the air and consistently engaging. People sometimes tell me that I am a survivor, but I think stamina and presence of mind under the present circumstances is superhuman. Well, warmest regards and wishes again from Harry. I don't know quite how do you respond. I sit here and I say things. Well, you know, it rained in the bedroom. It does. And part of the reason, you know, mold. You know that mold? Yeah. Like I said the other night, Buster Hart Grand built this house on the highest point of land on this little plateau here in the hills and hollers, and it turns out that the basement itself sits over a spring, and then when it rains in the house too, well, things get kind of damp. And mold grows. And it gives you nasty coughs and makes you feel generally like crap, and that's why Agnes is spending a bit more time away from here. But eventually, hopefully, we will fix things. The electricity, you know, we've got a member of the Horn Family Commune who could probably, with the aid of Skype and some video and stuff, maybe keep me from electrocuting myself as I go about working on some wiring issues. Thank you, Sparky, in advance. Before freezing weather comes, well, the freezing weather took out the plumbing. The derecho did take out the refrigerator, the microwave, the part of the stove, part of the water heater, and the washer and the dryer. But I don't say this as poor, pitiful me. That is not the purpose at all. And if you perceive that, please forgive me. Because I know that I'm living a life that is measurably better than that of God knows millions of people living in this capitalist free market, Ayn Randy and Milton Friedman-esque wonderland of opportunity. I know. And yes, it is. It's past tax time, and I'm reminded every time we go to pay the taxes on this property that I pay, with all of the things that I've described in an 80-year-old house, we pay more in taxes for 1 acre of this house and this ramshackle, rundown place that I love dearly. We pay more for this in taxes than a coal company pays on 1,000 acres of unmined land. It's a fact. An absolute fact. So it is with great thanks that I extend those thanks to Scott and to Jack and to Henry, who between the three of them have just taken us to $270 this evening. It's deeply appreciated. And, yeah, at some point in time, it has been suggested that we will try to get something going in the way of a Kickstarter campaign. And we'll take care of it, and that will include things like the roof and some equipment needs. I mean, it would be nice to have heat in the studio. Really nice in, like, February. It would be nice to have actual walls in the studio. Because there's a reason we don't do a lot of video here, because you'd see some hanging quilts covering up bare insulation in an unfinished room. That's what this is. And it's a tiny unfinished room. But that will be a collaborative process between us all, and I hope you will share your thoughts and your ideas on how to accomplish this. You know, should we try to build out, make the studio bigger? This is, of course, after we get done patching the holes in the Titanic, the roof, the plumbing, the electricity, things like that, weakened floors. But we can talk about all of that. Maybe, you know, I got to thinking, if we could pull it all together, what would you think if we launched a Kickstarter campaign on the Horn's anniversary? And ran it up to around Thanksgiving. It would seem appropriate, wouldn't it? So shoot me some notes, bobkincaid@gmail.com, and let me know what you think. Because as with everything, this is all going to be a collaborative process. As it has been from the very beginning. Sparky, you know, confirming, I can do that, Bob, you know, helping me not to get electrocuted. Good, good, because I am severely lacking in that kind of expertise. See, yeah. Irish Dave never misses a lick. But Bob, if your microwave's busted, what do you use as a receiver for orders from on high? The one true satellite. Jobs, like a job for Al, the one true inventor. Yeah. Oh, by the way, if you happen to wander by my Facebook page, don't be surprised if you see one of the strangest conversational threads I've ever engaged in. Gracious sakes. And I was doing this late last night. Sometimes it's hard to sleep after the program's over. And I was just reading along when all of a sudden I noticed my Facebook had some, like, crazy stuff. Just stuff that you guys never put this on my page. And I generally don't run across the Illuminati types. I mean, there's not a lot of interest. Whoa. But it was there. And so, you know, don't be shocked if you see some rather silly commentary from me on that thread. Okay, it's past silly. It's weird. It all starts off with a post about Alex Jones supports Zionist Israel. Silly me made a comment. Then we were off and running. Woohoo! So, yeah, don't email me. What the hell's going on here, Bob? I should probably not respond to things like that. But I did. Oh, well. It is Friday on the front porch here on the Horn. And there is more email. I have not talked, we have not talked, much at all about the attack in Nairobi. I'm about halfway ashamed of that because. But I tell you sincerely, I have run out of things to say about attacks on civil spaces and innocent men, women, and children, non-combatants. I've run out. I'm fresh out. I refuse to go down the Godzilla from Wasilla path and declare kill them all and let Allah sort them out. And I simply found badly wanting for any kind of an answer. And so I was really gratified when I got a note today from Dr. Allen. You'll recall it was Dr. Allen who served as my host and guide through my first experience ever with the state of Texas, everywhere from the little check-off wave of west all the way down to Austin. And Dr. Allen, I found out, is a fascinating man. A world traveler, and at the same time, a true, committed advocate for peace. It was at his invitation that I got to speak to the Waco Friends of Peace, whom I consider to be real heroes for having the courage to be progressive, liberal people in a place like Waco that is dominated by people who are decidedly not. You might recall that Baylor University is a Southern Baptist. It's the largest Southern Baptist school in the world. And you might recall that when his own denomination, the Methodists, told George W. Bush to not attack Iraq, the Southern Baptists said, "Don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes, George, and do it in the name of Jesus." They supported, the Southern Baptist Church did, the slaughter of the people of Iraq that resulted in something like a million or more excess deaths. They tallied that up by Halloween 2004, as a matter of fact. So it does take courage to be liberal and progressive in a place like Waco, and they continue, the Waco Friends of Peace continue to have my undying admiration. So Dr. Allen dropped me a note this evening. He said, "Greetings, Bob. I have some experience related to the recent mall attack in Kenya. Over the past 12 years, I frequently shop at this mall." Dr. Allen, I don't think, would mind me saying that he volunteers his time on an annual basis to go and provide his medical expertise to a hospital in Nairobi. Like I said, a lot of admiration. And so in Nairobi, over the past 12 years, he has frequently shopped at the Westgate Mall. He says, "I frequently shop at this mall, especially on Saturdays. There is more security already than we typically see at malls in the U.S. The parking is gated with armed guards in the parking lot. At the entrance of the mall, security guards carrying rifles are often present. On Saturdays, the mall is packed with people, a mix of Kenyans and expats from the U.S., England, India, etc. The grocery store is huge and crowded. It's a multicultural mix with people very polite and friendly. Kenya has a mixture of many Christians and Muslims, and folks normally have little conflict based on religion, to my knowledge. Shopping at the grocery store is an enjoyable experience for me. One feature always comes to mind. The store has the large shopping carts and the adults fill with groceries, but they also have tiny miniature carts for the kids to push around. The children were very cute pushing those around with their parents, sometimes with a doll or other toy inside the cart." Allen says, "I don't recall seeing these tiny carts in the U.S., so when I think of those children and adults of all nationalities being killed or injured by the terrorist attack, I feel a great personal sadness and loss. I hope for rapid recovery of those folks injured in the attack, and I suspect mall security will be very intense when I return to Nairobi in 2014. I just hope that Kenya tourism is not badly damaged by this event, as tourism is vital to the Kenyan economy." And when I read that, I had to stop and think, because since it was a mall, and I said I was ashamed for not having said much about this particular story, but the fact of the matter is it better to remain silent when one is at a loss for what to say? I think so. And so I sat and watched the story develop, and I saw on more than one for-profit media cable news channel the inquiry into, "Are we vulnerable in our malls? Is Al-Shabaab going to reduce our Walmarts to a heap of smoking rubble?" And I thought, Jesus Christ, here we go again. But then again, that may very well be my motto. Jesus Christ, here we go again. Or maybe it's the national motto. No more of that E Pluribus Unum business. Just print it on the back of the dollar bill. Jesus Christ, here we go again. That can be the reverse of the new motto on the Great Seal. Get rid of that "In God We Trust" business. And the business of America is business. And then you flip the thing over. Jesus Christ, here we go again. But it had that flavor to it. Oh, God. Be afraid. Be very afraid. You know, we spent how many years being afraid of a 6'7" Arab dragging around a portable dialysis machine in the Hindu Kush? Yeah. Be afraid. Fear. It's what for dinner. Yeah. Be afraid, America. Be very afraid. And so it will not be at all long now, I imagine. Wasn't there a really, really bad attempt at comedy in movie form a few years back called Mall Cop? And wasn't it the story of one of those sort of sadly degraded human beings who wear the dark trousers and the light blue shirt and try to look like a cop, but it just says... wackadoodle security on the patch. Well, you can expect. I even heard some blithering idiot. Well, do you think that we'll have to go through metal detectors like we do at the airport in our malls now to keep us safe from terrorism? And if it's being said out there in for-profit media land, you know that somewhere it's being floated as a potential response. Eventually, this will become a shoeless society simply because we will be taking off our shoes so often to go through metal detectors and scanners and whatnot that they will become superfluous. Shoes will be something that we wear as a status symbol to show that we have enough leisure time to constantly be removing and putting them back on. Maybe we'll wear them around our necks like some sort of talisman. But don't be surprised if in the coming months you hear people... But no, I don't know. I thought about that for a little bit and then I realized, wait a minute. This here's America, the land of the free, and the Second Amendment keeps us free. And the only thing that stop a bad Al-Shabaab guy with a gun is a good, God-fearing American Christian with a gun. So expect to see the NRA ginning up more concealed carry laws for the states that don't yet have them, and more broadening of them for those who do. So that we can all protect America's sacred sources of our freedom, our shopping malls. But as Dr. Allen points out, there were already armed guards in a gated parking lot. There were already armed guards at the entrances. And these were overcome. Sometimes a good guy with a gun can't stop a bad guy, or in fact, a lot of bad guys with guns. Which, if you're one of those people who believes that guns are the source of security and freedom, Wolverines! You're presented with a conundrum, because it means that you just have gun up and gun up and gun up until you finally reach some sort of quantum weight of firepower that doesn't exist, that no terrorist in their right mind would ever want to attack your local Wally World. And of course, that all that just blatantly ignores reality. Because reality is guns will never, ever, ever be the solution to terrorism. More firepower will never make terrorists decide to stop being terrorists. More drone strikes will never make people who feel aggrieved feel less aggrieved. Can we sort of digest that all the way down to our toenails? Because it's true. Don't you think that if firepower would have solved the problems of the Jim Crow era, Dr. King would have been out there preaching, "Everybody get a gun"? There were a hell of a lot more people, people yearning for freedom in India than there were British. And yet there was Gandhi begging people to adopt nonviolence. It's amazing for a Christian nation, or one that pretends to be one, the number of people who never got around to that. And you know, if you open up your little King James Bible, it's there in the red ink, not the black, the stuff that Jesus is alleged to have really said, "He who lives by the sword shall die by the sword." But they miss that, because they found a verse that they like better where Jesus says, "If a man hath not a sword, let him sell his cloak that he may buy one." I like that part. That means Jesus would have wanted a grenade launcher too. But it's not Wednesday. So I think we kind of have to... Yeah, see, there it is. Sandra just dropped me a note via Twitter. "Well, Kenya, with the U.S. blessing, destroyed Somalia's Union of Islamic Courts, so blowback." We will never, ever succeed in delivering democracy spitted on the end of a bayonet. Look, and you know, just because there's not a big body count and 10 or 15 people dying in IED attacks every day in Iraq anymore, don't think for an instant that the bloodletting has stopped there. Look at what a magnificent job we did delivering democracy spitted on a bayonet to the people of Iraq. In other words, not. So I think this thought-provoking message from Dr. Allen has a real chance to open another dialogue for us. And that is the idea that maybe it is time to pull back and re-examine foreign policy to the point where we really, really get serious about understanding whether or not the solution, all of our solutions, have to be at the muzzle of a gun. And maybe challenging some essential viewpoints, such as maybe folks just want to be left the hell alone. We may not like things that happen in other countries. We may find them morally reprehensible. but it does not mean that we unilaterally go out there and, you know what y'all need? Y'all need some democracy. Mm-hmm. You do. You do. You just need some democracy. And here it is. I'm sorry. We got it a little bloodied up when we had to stab it a few times to get it hooked on the bayonet. But y'all just reach out there and just think of it as one of your shish kebabs. Maybe it's time that that kind of thinking went the way of the dodo. And that way of thinking deserves to go the way of the dodo a hell of a lot more than the dodo deserved to go the way of the dodo. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Worth considering? Yeah, you tell me. But I really appreciate the note from Dr. Allen, because it provided badly needed food for thought. Tom Tomorrow has a wonderful panel, and of course talking about comic strips or cartoons on the radio is another aspect of dancing about architecture. But from This Modern World, in a panel with a building in the background, helicopters overhead, cop cars, armored personnel carriers with flashing lights, militarized police in the background, and a reporter in the foreground holding his microphone up, and the panel with text underneath it, the only time it makes sense to blame video games instead of guns, with the reporter saying, "And I'm here at the scene of the horrific killing spree where the rampaging killer beat a dozen people to death with an Xbox 360. The only time it makes sense to blame video games instead of guns. So we have that to discuss. And much more. One of the things that will challenge us if we are to have a discussion about perhaps being a little bit more humane here on the planet is the degree of ignorance that obtains in our own country, all over our own country. I mean, just because the story comes out of Mississippi doesn't mean that it couldn't happen in Massachusetts or California or anywhere else. God knows, West Virginia. The American Civil Liberties Union has released a letter that it has written to authorities or officials in Mississippi. Mississippi? Wait a minute. Well, they screwed up, because this is actually addressed to Jackson, Michigan. It's directed to the Mississippi Department of Transportation, 401 Northwest Street, Jackson, MI. That would be Michigan, not MS, Mississippistan, 39201, which is also Jackson, Mississippistan. Dear Commissioner King and Director McGrath, our Constitution's guarantees of religious freedom and equal protection under the law mean that law enforcement officers must put aside their personal prejudices and strive to treat all members of the public, regardless of race, ethnicity, national origin, or faith, with respect. Unfortunately, Mississippi Department of Transportation officers stationed in Pike County, Mississippi, appear to be unaware of these obligations. This is lawyerese. This is writing like lawyers write. appear to be unaware of these obligations. When, well, as you'll see, the real urge would be to say, these knuckle-dragging morons, and proceed apace. Earlier this year, during what should have been a routine traffic stop, DOT officers harassed and humiliated Jagjit Singh, a practicing Sikh, because of his religious beliefs. On January 16th, 2013, Mr. Singh, a commercial truck driver, was pulled over in Pike County on I-55 North by a DOT officer. The officer informed Mr. Singh that he had a flat tire on his truck and directed him to report to the Oskia way station. Mr. Singh drove to the station as instructed. Once there, he was subjected to a series of degrading remarks and events because of his minority faith and ethnicity. As a devout Sikh, Mr. Singh wears a turban and carries a kirpan. A kirpan is a small spiritual sword that is sheathed and sewn to the waistband. It, quote, is designed and worn as a religious symbol, much as a crucifix is designed and worn as a religious symbol by Christians. See State of Ohio versus Singh. No, it's not that this guy gets around, it's that that is a very common name in the Sikh faith. It is worn to remind Sikhs of their religious obligations to do justice, and is not a weapon. Indeed, because a kirpan is an article of faith, it is never used by an initiated Sikh as an offensive weapon. One federal court has even affirmed the right of Sikh children to wear a kirpan in public elementary schools. By footnote, the American Civil Liberties Union explains to these mouth-breathing snake handlers in Mississippi Stan, all of whom I have no doubt whatsoever vote Republican, initiated Sikhs wear five sacred articles of faith, which serve as a reminder of their spiritual commitment to God. These five articles of faith, known as the five Ks, are Kesh, uncut hair, covered by a turban, Kanga, a comb, Kara, a steel or iron bangle, the Kachaira, specially designed underwear, and the Kirpan, a small spiritual sword. Sikhs are required to wear these articles of faith at all times, including at work or school, when bathing, and even when sleeping. The kirpan is generally hidden from public view, as it is worn under clothing, secured in a holster-like sheath held by a gatra, a cloth belt. Now, as a person who rejects holy organized religion, I can't speak to why it is that their God requires headgear and weaponry, but I also don't understand why a religion whose avatar was murdered on a crucifix thinks that upon his return from the clouds, the guy who was murdered on a crucifix would ever want to see another one. It's beyond me, and I didn't come up with that by myself. Lenny Bruce asked the question. Bill Hicks asked the question. It has been asked a lot, you know. Why can't I remember his name? Comedian who said, if we had electrocuted Jesus instead of crucifying him, we would all be walking around with little electric chairs hanging around our necks, which is true. I don't know why God is so fascinated with hairdos and funny hats and stuff, but apparently they are. I feel much more free just being able to put my clothes on and go about my business without wondering if God's going to strike me dead for not wearing the headgear. But that's beside the point. The point being that in an interpretation of the First Amendment in the way, because remember, our Republican friends are all constitutional originalists, in trying to understand the First Amendment in the way that the framers of the Constitution intended it, the idea was to leave people free to believe whatever silly shit they want to believe, and let the rest of us get on about our lives. You got to have magic underwear? Good for you. You got to wear a special necklace? Congratulations. Wear two. Who cares? That is personal religious freedom. And so, the ACL continues, contending wrongly that his kerpon was illegal. The DOT officer demanded that Mr. Singh turn it over. Mr. Singh tried to explain that he was a Sikh and that the kerpon was a sacred religious article. He even showed him, and the other officers present, videos stored on his phone. Because, see, that's how weird, crazy, dangerous, and violent this country is. If you're a Sikh, and can see, I have a little personal experience with this. I remember one time when Boss Man Wayne, Bruce Birch, not Ben, Bruce Birch, and I were doing a gig in D.C., and we had to run and get some little piece of equipment up on Wisconsin Avenue in D.C. at the Best Buy there, and the ride we caught back was with a Sikh cabbie, and was one of the best cab rides I have ever had in my life. And he, too, had things to explain what it means to be a Sikh, because these were the days after September the 11th, 2001, when a Sikh was as likely or more likely than any other human being in this country to be dragged out of his car and beaten to death in retribution for the destruction of the Twin Towers and all the little altars of capitalism that were contained within it. Somewhere around here, I still got the booklet. Now, you know, I find it rather beautiful. The philosophy, and that's the thing. The underlying philosophy of most of this stuff is in some wise admirable. You know, that's why Thomas Jefferson wrote himself a New Testament that after he excised all the unbelievable horse shit out of it, he came up with a pretty decent little existentialist philosophy. But so, Mr. Singh, the truck driver in Mississippi Stan, good God, if it had been one of the Stan states, they might have been more understanding of the fact that he's a Singh. That's kind of depressing to contemplate, isn't it? Mr. Singh keeps always on his phone videos explaining what the Sikh faith is, that he is not, in fact, an over-the-road truck driver for Al-freaking-Qaeda. That they are also a religion of peace, like all other religions claim to be. So he even showed him and other officers present videos stored on his phone and on YouTube about the Sikh faith. In response, however, the officers laughed at him and mocked his religious beliefs. One officer declared, "All Sikhs are depraved and are terrorists." I find this portion of the letter from the ACLU to the Mississippi Department of Transportation a little bit hard to believe, that this member of the Mississippi DOT would say that Sikhs are depraved, because I have no confidence whatsoever that there is a single member of the Mississippi Stan Department of Transportation that even knows the word depraved. He then forced Mr. Singh to circle his truck with his hands on his turban while the other officers searched his vehicle and continued to taunt and laugh at him. Then, not content with this humiliation, they called another DOT officer to arrest Mr. Singh, claiming that he had refused to obey a lawful command. Simon says, pick your nose! I will not. You're under arrest for disobeying a lawful command, God. You depraved terrorist, you! I kind of regret the fact that none of the officers' names are in here, because when you behave like this, you really deserve to have your name known. Anyway, the officers' shameful treatment of Mr. Singh was an abuse of their authority and a betrayal of the public's trust that law enforcement officials will carry out their duties free from prejudice. You boys at the ACLU have never been to Mississippi Stan now, have you? Woo! That's a real knee slapper. Mr. Singh should be... we believe that this matter requires a full inquiry and that the officers who harassed Mr. Singh should be reprimanded. You know what that reprimand will consist of, right? Yeah, now, boys, damn it! What have I told you about harassing them people? You told us never let nobody see us doing it. Right! No witnesses! Damn it! Consider yourself reprimanded. Yes, sir. In addition, the letter continues, signed by Bear Atwood of the ACLU of Mississippi Stan. Oh, my God. They got the... At least they got the... I mean, these are Mississippi people who put M-I on. Oh, dear. In addition, this incident makes clear that the DOT desperately needs to educate its officers regarding minority faith communities. Sikhism is a well-recognized religion that dates back to the 15th century. There are currently over 26 million Sikhs around the world, including as many as 500,000 Sikhs in the United States. Sikhs believe in a single supreme God, oh, goody, monotheists, and that universal love above is the key to truth. Okay. That's a start. Sikhism's basic teachings state that Sikhs should earn an honest living, share their earnings, and contemplate the essential truth. The turban, kirpan, and other religious articles serve as important reminders of these religious dictates. The officer's ignorance of these basic facts likely contributed to their discriminatory treatment of Mr. Singh. Of course, the fact that officers may be unfamiliar with Sikhism or other minority religions does not give them license to harass and degrade members of the public who follow those faiths. In light of this incident, the DOT should also conduct regular trainings that emphasize an officer's duty to treat every person with dignity and to remain respectful of religious diversity. ask for the sun and accept the moon if they'll give it to you, right? And then there's a records request. But this is where it gets interesting. But that's not the end of the story. Horrifying as it is. Mr. Singh was not about to pay for a ticket on a violation which he had not, in fact, committed. So he took the Constitution of the United States, which is occasionally observed in a place like Mississippi Stan, at least with regard to people of certain flesh tones, and went to court. And while maybe we can say to ourselves that Goober and Gomer and Barney on that night at the way station on I-55 in Mississippi Stan behaved reprehensibly and, of course, also true to character and true to type, we would like to think that things would be promptly remedied as soon as they went just a little way up the food chain in the system there in Mississippi Stan, and we would, of course, be wrong. I mean, what was it, a couple of years ago when the sheriff's deputy arrested the vice president of Oh My God, the whole freaking corporation for Mercedes-Benz in Alabama because he didn't like the looks of his internationalist UN blue-helmeted driver's license, and the governor of Alabama called Mercedes. We didn't mean. Please don't take your SUV plant out of Tuscaloosa County where you're paying people $11 an hour to build vehicles that you're charging $75,000 for. Please don't do that. I mean, there was at least a reasonable response to this fifery. Get it? Not in Mississippi Stan. You realize that Alabama gets up every morning and collectively thanks Almighty God, whichever one they prefer, and they prefer the one that's nice and white and bearded and lives in the sky. They thank Almighty God every day for Mississippi. Mississippi just going at it hammer and tongs to make Alabama look good. So, no, you'd think that once it went up, but no. So, Mr. Singh appears in Pike County Court to protest his arrest and the charges against him. And that's when Judge Aubrey Rimes, R-I-M-E-S, no buying an H for these for these corn pones. Judge Aubrey Rimes looks at the defendant and says, "Counselor, I'll see you and your client in chambers." "Yes, Your Honor." "Yes, Uncle, Your Honor." At which point, Judge Aubrey Rimes, cloaked in all the majesty of the judicial system, I might add, looks at Mr. Singh and his lawyer and says, "Counselor, you tell your client right now that I done said to remove that rag from his head. Ain't nobody coming in my court wearing no rag on their head." And an absolutely perplexed Mr. Singh says, "I cannot. If it's an article of my faith, I am pledged to Almighty God always to wear the headgear that Almighty God approves and commands me to wear. For Almighty God loveth headgear." Which is his absolute and unchallengeable right under the Constitution of the United States, made manifest in the First Amendment. Which reminds me now that I have to reevaluate what I've been saying about the First Amendment for a while, to wit, that the First Amendment exists now largely only as a life support for the religion industry. We needed an adjective, Alex. The First Amendment in the United States, as proven by the Honorable Judge Aubrey Rimes presiding, already a court. The First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States is little more than a life support system for the Christian religion industry. The Sikhs apparently do not have enough money yet to be quite as religiously authentic as they need to be for someone like the Honorable Judge Aubrey Rimes to take cognizance of them. So after telling Mr. Singh to remove that rag from offing his head, and after Mr. Singh said he would not, the Honorable Judge Aubrey Rimes told the bailiff to escort counsel and his client from the courtroom and not to allow them back into the courtroom until the court had done with all of its other business. And so they waited until every last case on that day's docket had been heard. And then Mr. Singh went back into the courtroom. So, yeah, I mean, I go back to my initial thesis. Before we are going to be much in the way of any good, in not creating more enemies outside of the borders of the United States, I sincerely believe we're going to have to get much, much better at not antagonizing people within it. Jesus, wasn't it a Sikh temple that was attacked up in Wisconsin last year where a member of the police force behaving honorably as one would hope a member of the police force does, sat there and took bullet after bullet after bullet from a white Christian armed to the teeth teabagging until yes, it was. One can only thank an imaginary God that that Sikh temple was not located in Mississippi Stan, or else Barney and Gomer and Goober would have been standing there next to the white Christian gunned up goon locking and loading. Looky there! That one's got a purple towel on his head. You gotta lead him a little, Goob. Who? Jack writing in from Shreveport. Bob, it just so happened that I had a housemate in college that wore a turban and had the last name Singh. Yep, a common name. No sword, though. And, of course, maybe there are variations. Maybe some wear the knife and sword, or some don't. There's a broad and you know, I'm this is, just because I don't want to sign on doesn't mean that I don't have cultural respect for the culture. I just don't understand some of the bells and whistles. I prefer being an existentialist or something. But I had, let folks be. I mean, Anytime I think of the phrase, mind your own business, I hear it with a southern accent spoken by a southern grandma. Boy, what have I told you about minding your own business? Because I was the boy sometimes. You attend to your life and let everybody else tend to theirs, and it'll all just work out fine. Mercy. Ron and Raleigh writing in. We really don't like it. Subject line, democracy? We don't need a sinking democracy. We really don't like when countries come to their own democracy. Self-imposed democracies tend not to want other countries telling them what to do. Take Iran, for instance. We overthrew their democracy at the behest of the forerunner of BP, and just today, President Notshour was wagging his finger at the new president of Iran, telling him essentially that if they wanted an open relationship with the U.S., all they had to do was give up their sovereignty. Check our relationship to countries in Central and South America, and you'll see that our lip service to democracy is a big, steaming pile. Oh, P.S., just after 9/11, a couple of yahoos in Chapel Hill beat a Sikh half to death. I think they beat one all the way to death in New York, Ron. And this is nothing short of amazing. This is a note from our buddy Jay. Subject line, Kickstarter. As you may remember from past emails, my income is derived from a small VA pension, and you may also recall that I am infinitely rich in non-monetary ways. I have honed thrifty living to a science, and so I do okay. Due to a strange turn of events, For the last 7 months, my income has been a bit more than double the usual amount. Since my living expenses have, for the most part, remained unchanged, I have, as a result, amassed a bit of additional cash on hand. So please allow me to make a direct advance on a Kickstarter campaign. That direct advance was in the amount, moments ago, of $1,000. Thank you, Jay. Thank you so very, very much. We will treat that as such. A direct advance on a Kickstarter campaign. And we will do the things that are necessary to make this much, we hope, more sustainable. Thank you, Jay. And on behalf of all those who listen and are unable to contribute, thank you, Jay. And on behalf of those who contribute and keep contributing, thank you, Jay. Thank you, one and all. This is how we will indeed continue to be able to do this. So here at 16 minutes past the hour, I'm going to knock off with the filibuster and see if we can't get Friday on the Front Porch running. So there's your cue, Duncan. We'll take a break and come back. Lines are open, 304-658-3333. We can accommodate four folks on the phone, and Duncan is in charge of how many people he can accommodate on this Skype line. Jump in. It's Friday on the Front Porch, and I look forward to wherever y'all want to take the program. Let's see what kind of a crowd we got in here. Yep, we got a good crowd so far. We'll have more. We'll get it all fired up in just a few minutes. I'm still on my Van Morrison binge, so I hope you don't mind. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. God, I love that sax. Anyway.
bigger, stronger when you get the feel.
Van Morrison, Did You Get Healed? Of course, one of my all-time Desert Island albums is Astral Weeks, Van Morrison. You could be listening to that on an airplane across country and have some sort of amazing epiphanous experience. This is Friday on the Front Porch on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. 21 minutes past the hour, joined by in the Skype room, in the Skype chat, by Duncan, by Jay Cruzen, on and off by the sentient primate Steve, and by Larry and by Sergi. Hey, gang.
Hey, Bob.
How's it going, Duncan?
Hello, Bob.
Hey, Sergi.
I'll be right with you. I got a guy that knows something about Kickstarter that might be in the room here. Just to hang on. I'll okay. be back.
All right. Stand by. All right.
Go
then,
ahead.
Let's check out who's on the phone lines. And there are two more lines open on the phones if you want to jump in. Hey, who have I got?
Hey, you got that old senile musician from Cleveland.
Well, what'd you do with Phil?
He's the same guy.
Oh, okay.
When you talk to him, you know.
No, I'm not going to say anything. Stand by. Let's see.
But one thing about the school of insult comics I listen to, you learn to poke that finger at yourself too.
Well, self-deprecation is because I have to use the big words, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm so stinking insecure as it is.
Well, don't worry. Back in my generation, we call it self-deprecation. Pun is still the lowest form of the joke.
It is subterraneanly low, absolutely.
Well, I'm not.
And we have some real practitioners too. Irish Dave, my God, is amazing, Bill. That man can pun anything.
Well, I've heard a few come to me that I had to pick my fat ass off the floor from laughing so hard.
Stand by. Let's bring one more phone line on. Hey, who've I got?
Hey, this is Kevin.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Good. Good.
Good, good. Welcome. Well, welcome one and all to Friday on the Front Porch.
Hello.
Yeah, hey, Steve.
Yeah, hi there.
How's it going?
Not too bad.
Excellent.
Up in Canada.
Hey, you know what? We need our north of the border input.
Wouldn't mind a little north of the border weather either.
That's beautiful up here.
Humidified or what?
No, about 68 degrees, no humidity, nice sunny day, beautiful, nice fall weather.
Awesome, and you're getting roasted, Jay Cruzen?
It's in the 90s down here in Florida today.
Ugh. With like 150% humidity?
Yeah, there you go, pretty much. Actually, the front just went through, so it wasn't quite that humid, but it didn't drop much.
See, that's the thing that shocked me so much. I was expecting, and Sergi can speak to this, when I went to Texas, I was expecting heat. I was not expecting just the bone-drenching humidity. Where's that come from?
Basically, Bob, the thing about Texas weather is this.
there's three main biomes, climate types, whatever the term is, in the state of Texas. The western third is desert, the middle third is prairie, and the eastern third, and this is the part that a lot of people aren't aware of, especially ones that are not from this part of the state, is a subtropical rainforest.
I'm a believer.
Dallas-Fort Worth, Waco, down to Austin, and over to Houston are all in that tropical rainforest zone.
Okay, so may I interject something here? I think the reason for all the humidity in the rest of the state is because all the rest of that is, all that subtropical crap's going to become a desert too. And it's just all evaporating out and flowing right over you.
And see, I was thinking about this a little bit earlier when I saw the IPCC stuff that hit today. And they predicted, and you know, these guys always, being scientists, they always work the conservative end of the street. Conservative in terms of, you know, not being some sort of wild-eyed reactionaries that they try to take their science seriously, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that they noted was that while, air temperatures have not been rising as we would have expected, they think that's because the oceans have sucked up a lot of that, which means we've heated the oceans up, which means more transpiration process, yada, yada, yada. But the other part of it that just kind of grabbed me was that they said, oh, by the way, we think in the next 100 years there's going to be between 1 foot and 2 feet of sea level rise. And I was immediately reminded of the Rolling Stone article that we talked about a good bit from a few weeks back called Goodbye Miami. Jason, I think I overtalked you. I didn't mean to.
No, I think I tried to overtalk you, and I was going to say that's awfully conservative. 100 years, 2 feet, nah, bullshit. It's going to be a lot more than that.
But, I mean, you know the lay of the land down there. What does that look like? I mean, 100, really? 1 foot, 2 foot? What's that going to do to the people?
Well, I'm thinking there's a good chance that in the next 100 years, we'll lose the entire Greenland ice sheet. If that happens, you're talking about 3 meters. You're not talking about a few feet.
And I did happen to notice that the Northwest Passage has been traversed. You know me, I camp out over at Charlie Pierce's blog and read. You know, if the man was writing the ingredient list of a toothpaste tube, I'd read it because it would be written very well. But he had a story noting that the Northwest Passage has been traversed, you know, from the Pacific to the Atlantic, ice-free passage all the way across the Arctic. And of course, the Goddess of Irony was on board. Anybody want to guess what kind of a vessel it was?
Oil tanker.
Close, no cigar. Worse, actually.
Carrier.
Nope.
Coal transport.
Liquefied gas.
Nope. Kevin wins it. It was a coal ship.
I'll be
bound. Bound for Finland. I thought the Finns had wised up. But
I
guess
I think you're getting Finland confused with Norway and Sweden.
Okay, thanks, Sergi. Now the Finnish contingent of the Horn family commune will send me hate mail. I'll forward it to you.
Well, thank you,
Bob. A big hunt for the Northwest Passage back in the history of this country, or there was a movie about it.
Oh, absolutely. No, wasn't that Cabot?
Yep.
The explorer Cabot, and wasn't Prince Henry the Navigator? Didn't he have a bit of a thing about a Northwest Passage?
Yeah, there was a lot of talk of it. Yes.
Oh, and by the way, guys, because we don't have, and I use that generically, but by the way, I mentioned that really, really goofy thread on my Facebook page. I was really proud of myself because after a while I got into the swing of things and I was really, really cooking with the paranoid gas, as it were. And this is the one I was proudest of. because, you know, there were references, you know, to the Jews. But this I was proud of, because I'd already exposed myself as a member of the Knights Templars. Well, I am. I was initiated. That's like the upper level of D-Malay, and I was a D-Malay when I was a boy. And yeah, I got initiated as a member of the Knights Templars.
Did you do your duty over there yet?
No. I've, like Dick Cheney, gotten a deferment.
Okay.
Or several. So after establishing my cred as having an in with the Illuminati and folks like that, I explained, you're going to love this. I was so deeply proud of this. What you don't know is that neither Julius Caesar nor Augustus ever found the secret hoard of priestly Egyptian gold. It was later found by Raphael the painter, who went to Egypt to study mummies' bodies because the Jesuits forbade vivisection. He, in turn, secreted the gold until it could be transferred to the New World on Columbus's second voyage. And all those Spanish gold ships weren't bringing gold from Nueva España, but they were instead money laundering the lost gold of the pharaohs back into the hands of the Black Pope. Is that good or what?
That sounds pretty good.
People believe this crap, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Man, I should have been a car salesman. Damn. I missed out on making a lot of dough.
See, you're in... All those years fooling around with those harps, you know, no. Wrong racket, Bill. Wrong racket.
Waste. I mean, I made a decent living for a blues player. I can't bitch too loud. It was being, well, we were the first in the area, you know. I mean, come on. I caught that original Butterfield Band at a Lake Erie College job in the fall of 65, the only time Bloomfield and a whole bunch of them ever appeared here. Called luck. I loaned the record to a woman who went to school there, and she gave it back to me and said, hey, these guys are coming here. Thank you. I blew a car engine coming back from there, but I gave a damn about that. They were too easy to find another one and throw it in.
Out under the shade tree, right, Bill?
Yeah. Nah, I was lucky. My first wife's brother was a diesel tech graduate. And him and a buddy of his did a clutch on this Nova that we had dumped a 325 in. You know, well, three hundred some Chevy motor, I watch these guys do a clutch with hand tools in an hour and a half. I'm still wondering how the hell they did it.
You know, we used to have in another county where I lived, we had a family of absolute criminals. I won't name names, so I won't be sued. They ain't listening, but they were. I mean, it was born into them. Know that probably runs counter to some previous conversations we've had with Dr. John about, you know, the power of genetics and stuff. But these guys were. I mean, they were just born to be brawlers, fighters, car thieves. I mean, if it wasn't nailed down, they were more than happy to steal it. But they were also, at the same time, some of the most brilliant mechanics you've ever met in your life. And I knew people who told me about watching them tear an engine down to its essential pieces, put it back, completely rebuild it, and have it inside a car inside of 2 hours.
Guys like that made me delirious. Why can't I do it, you know?
Well, exactly.
My specialty was turning the air blue when I worked on a car. My first mother-in-law, so I asked my wife, does he have to talk that way? And then her son went to diesel tech school, and she heard him talk that way. So, you know, it's an inherited language.
Go ahead.
Isn't necessity the mother of an invention, though, if they're a bunch of...
Yeah. Well, you read the Grapes of Wrath, and these guys repairing junk cars on the way to California was, you know, something else, too. That was the American way when I was young. The uncles and everybody, they could repair. If it was broke, they'd fix it. And nowadays, I wish somebody would go down to Washington and... Well, there's a bunch of Republicans that need their clocks fixed down there, as far as I'm concerned, but, you know.
No, they need them cleaned.
Cleaned, yeah, you got it. Well, there's a change in expressions over the years. Yeah, because when I heard it, it was... In the 50s, it was fixed. Now it's clean. Same difference. You got it.
Yeah.
Changing language.
If you take free health care away from Ted Cruz, because he's got that health care for life for being a congressman, watch him scream and yell about his health care being taken away, but he doesn't mind taking our health care away from us.
Well, neither he nor Joe Manchin.
Nope.
I mean, I mentioned this last night on the program. I'm seriously, personally affronted by this. And it's past even the word insult. The idea that I've got a millionaire senator who would say that, who has said that health care is too good for the likes of me. I mean, and too good for the likes of my darling daughters and my, and my son. You know, that's one of those that makes you stand out on the back stoop and just holler F you to the, until he hears. I mean, that takes a lot of nerve, doesn't it?
Well, you know all the crap you hear about the Canadians complaining about their health care? I used to hit Toronto, I must have been 5-6 years in a row on my way to a place to fish called Rice Lake up near Peterborough, and I always stop in. At Niagara, there was a Hungarian restaurant. They'd bring out a platter of food that was tremendous, and then the next day go to Toronto and shop in Sam Goody's record store, buying old jazz and whatever else you wanted was there. And you talk to people about the health care, I never heard a complaint from a working class person up there.
No, not. Oh, by the way, a note just came in from Dr. John after that mention about, you know, the Aztec gold, or, well, the Pharaoh's gold. And I need to put a little bit of a postscript on that story, because after I put that wad of crazy out there, the response I got was, yep. Total agreement. So Dr. John just wrote in and said, the truth about the Templars, finally. Yeah. Oh, God, Bob. Michelangelo stealing the Pharaoh's gold, money laundering through the Aztecs for the Black Pope, and then, and understand, Dr. John never, ever, ever types in all caps. This is the first time I've ever seen it from him in, you know, several years of correspondence now. It all makes sense now. All of history. Yeah. And then back to normal typing, he said, seriously, that laid me out.
Well, you had me thinking. I got to ask the crew here. We're not the people who were Sikhs or Sikhs. Did they not put many men in the English army as special soldiers?
Are you thinking of the Gurkhas?
Gurkhas is one, too, but there, I think the Sikhs might have had a group.
I think you may be right.
Yeah, thanks, because I can't remember everything anymore, like what I had for lunch, you know.
I'm not sure, but I have a feeling there's research going on about that, even as we speak.
And Kenya. What was the damn... Wasn't that where the Mau Maus came from? Years ago, Kenya was not that one of the first places that that had a revolt against English overlordship.
I know there was a strong urge toward freedom from colonial rule, and there's a fascinating story. You know, the first president was Jomo Kenyatta.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the current president his last name is Kenyatta. I'm not sure if that's hereditary or not, but I remember hearing a story years and years ago about a man, I think in Chicago, who everywhere he went would spray paint things with "Free Jomo Kenyatta," because I guess the English had imprisoned him.
Yes.
They
tried that every place they went at first until they found that didn't work either. So
Plan B. I'm historically ignorant, and I'm ashamed of it, and I'll work on my literacy there.
Well, I can't remember as well as I used to, you know.
But here's the interesting part. When Kenyan freedom was finally established, when they were going to officially become their own nation, this man, and I can't remember his name, had so much, such a profound influence on raising the issue in the United States that they wanted to honor him as a dignitary invited to the ceremonies. And it turned out, if I recall the story correctly, it turned out that he had just liked the sound of the name, Jomo Kenyatta, had no idea what was going on, and was, in fact, as mad as a March hare. And yet helped to, by what some would call his madness, had helped to deliver the people of the new nation of Kenya out of colonial bondage.
Well, there was a book and a movie, I think, that was based on the. I mean, that was the backstory of the whole book was the revolution against the British in Kenya. And I'll be damned if I can remember the damn name of it now. I can't remember it.
You mean Rhodesia?
Well, Rhodesia was another one.
Well, Kenya used to be Rhodesia.
Okay, that was it.
No, that's Zimbabwe.
No, Zimbabwe. Yeah.
I saw.
Rhodesia was Cecil Rhodes, was it not? I think the English asshole.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a little opinion of that stuff.
Speaking of remembering, the email I was supposed to have sent you got kicked back to me. So I'll give you a call tomorrow and make sure I've got the right email address and that.
Okay, we'll worry. I think it's the right one I gave you, but that's the way it goes. I mean, I don't write to myself, but I've reached a point in life where I may talk to myself a lot, but I haven't started writing to myself yet. That'll be next week. Don't live too long. You start to... You know.
And in answer to your question, Bill, Dr. John noting Sikh sepoys regularly fought alongside British soldiers during the frequent tribal revolts on the Afghan frontier in famous regiments such as Rattray's Sikhs, and the young Winston Churchill nearly lost his life rescuing a wounded Sikh when he fought in the Malakand campaign of 1897. At the Battle of Saragarhi on 12 September 1897, 21 Sikhs from the Indian Army's Sikh Regiment won awards for gallantry. So, yes, you are correct.
They have a reputation for themselves there, which really bothers you when this poor guy's getting harassed to hell by some... I played bars that were in the middle of the hottest district... in one of the more violent districts in Cleveland, and it was on a college campus, so these guys would hang out there because they'd get off second shift, and, you know, they'd be all over the bar. And I've got to know a lot of them, fished with a few of them. And I like these guys a lot more because when you talked to them, you found out they had taken a pleasure trip to Southeast Asia under the auspices of the U.S. government. And some of these guys didn't have to prove anything to anybody. And they spoke, a lot of them, with high praise for the men that wore the pajamas that fought against them.
Yeah.
They had a high regard for these guys. So they were damn good at what they did. And that takes a certain amount of courage to it. And that's what bothers me when I hear a lot of this stuff. The other guys are always a no-good coward, and your guys are the best in the world, and... Yeah, somebody hand me a shovel so I can get rid of some of this crap. In my opinion.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
I got Greg from Malloy Chat in the room.
Oh, hey, Greg.
Hey, Bob, how are you?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Oh, good. Hanging out on Friday afternoon?
Very nice, very nice. Evening coming on here.
Greg and I talked a while back about doing a Kickstarter. I think he said he might be able to set it up for you.
That would be awesome. We need to, you know, I think we need to make it a collaborative, like I said earlier, a collaborative effort, Greg, and just come up with some things that'll make the horn a little bit more sustainable.
Yeah, we probably need to talk to Mike, or I can talk to George, and because it seems like he was running it for Mike.
Yeah, I'd. The other night, Kathy got behind. Keyed her microphone and said something about eating yogurt in her pajamas, and I asked her why she was eating yogurt in her pajamas, because around here even us hillbillies use the beach. and then added, of course, last night I shot an elephant in my pajamas, and what an elephant was doing in my pajamas I'll never know. But she said she would be glad to have her brain picked. So yeah, we'll sort. And I think the timing of it, Greg. If what I put forward earlier, what better day to start it than on the anniversary of the horn, which would be October 24th.
Oh, okay.
The one
I didn't know that one.
Though, Bob, is can these Kickstarter campaigns run for more than a month? Because I know with Mike's, that was kind of my frustrating thing, is, you know, it only ran for about a month, and that kind of kept me from donating to that. And
yeah, I think Spike Lee's is still running.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you're trying to sort out problems, the longer it runs, the longer one has to wait to be able to deal with the problems one is dealing with.
Yes, that's correct.
Because, I mean, I had contributed to Mike's Kickstarter too, and you know, I saw last night the little note in my email: we have charged your account.
Yes, yes. Payday doesn't come until the end.
Right. Oh, by the way, Greg, I love your Keith Richards avatar.
Yeah, good old Keith.
Or Keith.
Yeah, I'm actually somewhat related to him.
Are you really?
We share the same aunt.
Wow.
My mom's brother was in England for the war and came home with an English girl. And that is Keith's mom's sister.
Well, how about that?
Now, I've never met him, but some of my cousins have, especially the two cousins.
Oh, are you a big Stones fan, Greg?
Oh yeah, always more Stones than Beatles.
I've been a long time coming to it, but the eternal debate throughout the classic rock and roll era was always Beatles versus Stones. And it seemed like it always came out to, you know, Stones number two, Beatles number one. I think I've gotten to a place in my world where it kind of has to be Stones number one, Beatles number two. One, because the Beatles didn't have any staying power.
Right, right. And they were too poppy.
Yeah.
I first heard the Stones play blues, and that was it, man. They were what I really, you know, I went for that over. I mean, the Beatles, my sister was a big fan of English music hall music. And when you listen to some of the Beatles stuff, was really a dead-on echo of English music hall stuff, the humorous things in particular.
And a lot of that was Paul.
Yeah.
I mean, all the way up into his solo career, he liked to do that really tinny early microphone effect, you know, where it was all treble and there was no, you know, no bass or anything to it whatsoever. And it always kind of had a tongue-in-cheek flavor to it. I think Bill, that when the Stones sallied into blues, they did so with a more organic quality, if you will, or you know, a more honest appraisal of the blues.
Yep.
Would you agree?
Yeah. Well, one of their early instrumentals is 2120 South Michigan Avenue. That was the Chess Records address.
Ah.
What I've read, and you know, now maybe whoever wrote that was wrong, but that was the story that I picked up off of music magazines and such.
Well, Greg, the reason I asked you about the Stones was because there is there's a documentary that's come out in the last year or so, and it's really well done. And I think it's just called Muscle Shoals, MuscleShoals, Muscle Shoals.
Okay. The studio in the South,
and it's all about the Muscle Shoals music scene and the impact that it had on the rock and roll, soul, you know, what have you, country, and within that documentary there is a segment on when the Stones came to record, because they recorded if not the entirety, then a significant portion of Sticky Fingers at
yes.
Muscle Shoals Sound.
Yeah.
And there are there's a passage, and you got to understand, when they were there, they were recording in Colbert County and staying at the, and I've been to that Holiday Inn that used to stand there in Florence, Alabama, in Lauderdale County, across the river from each other. Both counties were dry. And if you can imagine Keith Richards trying to record an album in a county where you cannot easily obtain a bottle of liquor.
Wow.
There's a passage.
That's hard to imagine.
Yeah, there's a passage in there that, we had to find a bottle of liquor for Keith. And there's footage of him sitting there behind the mix desk in the recording studio with, like, you know, a half a gallon of Jack Daniels in his hand or Cutty Sark or something like that.
And a cigarette hanging out of his mouth.
Absolutely. And odds are, just the way things were down there, I'm betting they did not drive to Huntsville, Alabama or Savannah, Tennessee for that bottle of liquor. I'm betting that probably came from the sheriff of Colbert County. I kid you not, because my dad the worked for Reynolds Metals Company, and that was back in a time when they made a passing marginal effort to be occasionally decent to their employees. So they had a fish camp on the banks of the Tennessee River. And every so often they would have a fish fry. And anybody who's ever been to a southern fish fry, and probably a Wisconsin fish fry for that matter, knows that, well, yeah, there's some seafood there, but there's a hell of a lot more beer and liquor.
Yeah, you have to have alcohol when you're around those fish, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the fish's contract, right?
Yes.
So what would happen is Reynolds would want to do a fish fry, and they would contact the sheriff of Colbert County, Alabama, and buy liquor that the sheriff of Colbert County, Alabama, had recently confiscated when he shook down the local bootleggers. Because most people think of bootleggers as being somebody who sells moonshine. No. These were the black market underground liquor retailers of the dry counties. So they would go and shake down the bootleggers, and they would, and the sheriff's office always had a constant inventory of beer, wine, liquor, what have you. And that's
women.
Probably. And that's what would supply the booze for these things, and I'd like, that's what makes me think that that's probably where Keith Richards' bottle came from, because I didn't see a tax stamp on it. And the other funny part about that is that our phone number when I was a kid was one digit off from the bootleggers. And so whenever it was time to shake down the bootlegger, what you wanted to do, the way you wanted it to work, was for the sheriff's deputies to arrive at the scene, and you're not there, and they just confiscate all the liquor. And so periodically we'd get a call like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, and it would just be a voice on the other line saying, "Tell Jackie we're on the way." Click.
Wow.
And before mom or dad could say, no, this isn't the boot. And so sometimes Jackie would be there. And it, you know, and then they'd have to charge him, and then he'd have to get bailed out, and then there'd be a trial. And my county, the two counties I grew up in, did not go wet, so to speak, until the fall of 1981, after I left for college. And there would be referendums periodically throughout my early years. And whenever somebody wanted to go wet, a coalition would arise called the Lauderdale Citizens for Decency and Morality that would be fronted by the local churches and funded by the bootleggers. See, we can have political accommodation and get stuff done in this country when we want to.
Right.
Because the bootleggers had an economic interest in continuing their black... Because a black market bottle of liquor in a dry county is a hell of a lot more expensive than it is retail.
Yep.
And the churches wanted to, because it was a lot better for the deacons just to quietly show up at Jackie's house or Miss Inez's and go and get their bottle, and they knew that Miss Inez or Jackie would keep their confidences for them. But if it went wet, then the deacons would have to walk through the front of the liquor store just like all the common hoi polloi.
They didn't want to get seen in there, did they?
No. And so consequently, but they finally lost in 1981, and I came home from college on Christmas break to my very first wet county. And I was also old enough at that time to drink in a wet county. And it was just bizarre. But they're still fighting that battle down there because I think they finally just passed a law in the last few years where in those two counties you can get a beer, glass of wine, or drink with your dinner in a restaurant on a Sunday. Because wow. they're still establishing religion via government action by forbidding the sale of any alcoholic beverage by anybody on a Sunday. And then there was also a constant battle over trying to bring in draft beer. Can you imagine that?
Well, Bob, they had blue laws in the city of Cleveland in the 50s where stores couldn't be open. Department stores, anything.
Right. No, I grew up with blue laws, too.
Yep. You guys dumped them after we did. That's what made it even, you know. Because this was up until we were like 55 or so when you couldn't really shop for much of anything on a Sunday.
We just recently out here okayed the selling of beer and alcohol on Sundays in grocery stores. I mean, you're talking 2013 and, you know.
How did a minority of people like these wacko religious types, how the hell did they grab control of the controls on the engine?
Because they're not the minority you think they are, Bill.
I guess you're right, yeah.
And as noted between the bootleggers and the churches, yeah, and in fact, the guy who foisted prohibition off on the United States, what was his name, Brady, was it? Ken Burns did that brilliant documentary a couple of years back.
Yeah.
And it really impressed upon me because he said, you know, we don't need a majority. We just need a plurality.
Well, didn't a lot of the push on that came out of Oberlin College? If somebody can look that up.
Well, and the other thing is a great deal of the push on prohibition was from the progressive and liberal movements. I mean, the Women's Temperance Union was a liberal group.
Yeah, it was probably a voting group. Women trying to
get... That too.
Oh, yeah. Because people band together for things, they'll pick up little issues on the, you know, that are part of the... You wouldn't think would be part of their what they're doing, but it becomes that one. Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, I went to more anti-war demonstrations during the Vietnam era, and a lot of these guys that I happen to know pretty well personally, they were down there for one reason.
Yeah.
God awful good looking women hanging out there. You know, it was
you mean the eternal motive?
Yeah, that's one that's constant. Sensuality and sexuality are constant motives, regardless of what anybody's area is, it's there. Did you lose me?
No. You're right there. Right there.
I heard something in the background. Thought maybe.
No, somebody had some background noise over on the Skype channel.
Oh, okay.
I had the story out of Mississippi about the Sikh man being, yeah. You know, to get
well,
that rag
got me
off your head.
About their service to the English army over the years. Yeah.
Yeah. The support.
These were some tough guys. If this bunch of state coppers had to deal with a room full of guys during the Second World War, they might have been really in bad shape.
Oh, without a doubt. Well, I was just going
because
to.
The guy wears his hair differently doesn't mean you can push him around like a, you know.
No, or kill him.
Yeah, bully, kill. I mean, the whole thing is so ridiculous. I mean, when you look at it in its simplest form, it's like, are you people freaking stupid? Well, that's a stupid question.
Yeah, there you go. Note coming in from Fritz in Arkansas, who knows a little bit about dry counties. Fritz says, the county I reside in is bone dry. And that was the kind of county I grew up in, bone dry. That means not even any private clubs that sell drinks. Fritz notes, Arkansas liquor laws are complex and strange, and they're designed to be that way. Only four towns in Arkansas allow the sale of packaged liquor and beer, wine on Sundays, and this does not include Little Rock. Even in Arkansas's wet counties, there are dry towns and townships. Absolutely the truth. Same thing here. And it goes under the guise of local control. This here is democracy, and we don't want that.
Well, especially when you have to bribe us to get what you want.
Exactly.
So you were fixing to say about that ACLU story, Bob?
Well, no, I was just going to say that there's another one out there that I thought might be fun for us to consider. This one comes out of Kansas, Stan. Duncan, is somebody having issues?
No, not at the moment.
Okay, I'm getting some clicking and popping here, and I just didn't know where it was coming from. No mind. No, this story comes out of Kansas, Stan. Apparently, Kansas has a state board of education that has the crazy notion that they are going to actually teach science in their schools. And, of course, they have adopted a set of universal science standards for Kansas classrooms that apply from kindergarten to 12th grade. The Christians are not happy. Two separate lawsuits have been filed. And the reason I mention this, do you remember when we had the story about California deciding to let children be defined other than by their sexuality, you know, especially like little kids, you know, up through high school? And we had a bunch of outcry by the right wing, and somebody referenced the Pacific Justice Institute, I think. Well, lo and behold, the shores of the Pacific apparently lap the verges of Topeka. I kid you not, because that's the dateline on this story. And the headline on this press release is "Atheistic Elementary School Instruction Challenged." So because the science is religion neutral, it is thereby defined as atheistic. These goobers writing as follows: families across Kansas became one step closer. Oh, I bet you down here somewhere there's going to be some begatting too. Families across Kansas became one step closer today to protecting their children from forced atheistic teaching in their public school system. Pacific Justice Institute filed a complaint in federal district court challenging the State Board of Education's adoption of certain science standards, which would create a hostile learning environment for those of faith. We don't know what those are that are of faith, just those of faith. Those snail darters of faith? Those slugs of faith? Those, oh, wait a minute, strychnine-drinking, floor-rolling, tongue-speaking, snake-handling, yeah, of faith. The standards being challenged are the next generation science standards adopted by the BOE June 11th, 2013, and the corresponding framework for K-12 science education, practices, cross-cutting concepts, and core ideas. In addition to citing numerous areas of law that the standards violate, the complaint cites the standards cause the state to promote religious beliefs that are inconsistent with the theistic religious beliefs of plaintiffs, thereby depriving them of the right to be free from government that favors one religious view over another. I dare say Dr. John is kicking furniture right now, because I know I did, and y'all probably are too. You got that? If you teach something that is religion neutral, in other words, if you don't have Jesus right there in the Petri dish when you're learning about microscopes in ninth grade, If the bleeding Christ on his crucifix is not pinned into the wax right there in the dissection pan in 10th grade biology, if Boyle's gas laws are not activated by the loving power of Christ Jesus in 11th grade chemistry, and if a pound of lead falls at the same rate as a pound of feathers from a 20-story building in 12th grade physics and does it without Jesus, well, that means that it's a different religion. This stuff makes my head hurt, guys. Did I lose everybody?
I don't know.
No.
Anybody? Anything?
I feel like I've been talking too much because nobody else is talking. Come on, fellas.
Can you hear us?
Yeah, you're there.
I don't think there's any Jesus in any of that, if you actually paid attention to what the little guy wandering around the Middle East said 2,000 years ago.
Well, for starters, the fact that he lived in a time when people who lived where he lived thought that the four elements were earth, air, fire, and water, you know, you've got a jumping off point. But, yeah, no, the teaching biology without Jesus in it is going to be a government endorsement of religion. You hope, and see, you know, the reason I brought this up is Bill asked that question a couple of minutes ago about how did these people get their hands on the engine? And if this thing is not just, it shouldn't just be bounced out of court, it should be summarily dismissed with prejudice, and sanctions should be assessed against the Pacific Justice Institute for the filing of a frivolous and a lawsuit designed only for harassment. The lawyers who put their name at the bottom of these pleadings should be compelled to stop being lawyers. Because that's the only way you're ever going to keep them from getting their hands on the dead man switch, Bill. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to be a lawyer so bad I almost sent the matchbook cover from this Blackwell School of Law, the one that had to tell you on the back, do not mail matches, you know?
Oh, yeah. Did you also have to send in a drawing of the pirate or Spunky the Turtle or something?
No, I never. I couldn't draw flies at a picnic, Bob. I was the worst visual artist you ever saw in your life.
But this stuff, just the filing of this stuff frightens me. Because you remember when the Bush administration said, we have to win all the time. They only have to win once. We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Well, that line of reasoning applies to this, too. If one court that happens to have some sort of holy roller on it says, I agree, science that ain't got Jesus in it is a different religion. It might be them Muslims. Then everything goes to hell.
Well, I can say, you know, I can look back on the history of Europe, and I can say that... Well, I think you and I were talking about that the other night, that a lot of Islam, when it first started, man, they rolled through North Africa and all the way up to the Pyrenees and were at the gates of Vienna twice.
Mm-hmm.
So they've had a problem in their religion where the secular leadership gloms onto the religion, uses that to motivate people to put money and power on them, to put money in their pockets and power in their hands.
Because, you know, the more Muslims you get, the more money you get. But that's the same thing with Christianity. The more Christians, the more money.
Well, we had a great story in Cleveland, a church where my second wife went to school. She was RC like I was. The first one was Jewish.
Royal Crown? You weren't Pepsi or Coke?
No, I was Roman Catholic.
I got it.
We were lucky. I never had priests or brothers that were chasing me around. Thank you. Except with their hand out looking for a donation. You know, they were doing that a lot. But, you know, there was a bunch of guys that got caught at a church that she went to as a kid that were videotaped. These were guys who passed the collection around, and they caught them emptying those baskets into their pockets whenever they could.
Imagine that.
It happened pretty hard, I'll tell you.
The name of Jesus.
Yeah, it's... And we had a guy down here running a church in a movie theater, and he had a guy dumping chicken blood on people till the Cleveland Press caught him. There's always a faker somewhere.
These people aren't Christians. They're insane.
Yeah.
These aren't the people that are going to pass through the eye of the needle. These are insane people that I don't know where the hell they come from or what rock they crawled out from under. But they're not Christians.
Yeah, but Jason, remember, there's a reason I call it the religion industry.
Yeah, and I agree. I am totally against organized religion, period. I hate it all of them.
You won't get an argument here.
But see, there are people who go twice a week and deposit a paycheck signed by the executive director of the Pacific Justice Institute. And seeing as how they're lawyers, it's probably a pretty tasty paycheck. And, of course, it's a Christian paycheck. And then, but if you were to dig around a little bit, you'd probably find a whole bunch of really creepy people, really creepy rich people, fronting the Pacific Justice Institute.
Because yep, there you go, right there.
Got it.
Yeah.
It's on for a minute, but...
Oh, all right.
I mean, I never thought I'd see the day when my first election I had a chance to vote against Barry Goldwater. And if now, if I had to choose between him and Godzilla from Wasilla and the governor of Texas and this other guy, the senator who was doing the filibuster, Barry would start looking pretty good. That really scares me.
Talking about who, Bill?
Goldwater. Because if given a choice between him today and what's his name, the governor of Texas, I can never remember these names anymore, or that state, yeah, that senator down there that just did the filibuster, what a...
Yeah, Goldwater looks positively brilliant compared to some of the Republicans that are,
in prominence today. I went to Burt Society meetings, and we used to have a good time harassing those guys, but who is the two richest guys in the country, the Koch brothers?
The Koch brothers.
Their father was a big shot in the Birch Society.
Well, there's a John Birch Society because of the Koch brothers' daddy.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, look, can we talk about that for just a
minute? I thought it was Robert Welch.
Welch was in on it too.
Welch founded it. Welch founded it, Larry, but Koch funded it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because Koch came back from a job developing oil resources. Wasn't it oil? In the Soviet Union, and he had a grudge against old Joe Stalin.
Stalin stiffed him?
Yeah, I think Stalin stiffed him.
Well, that'll do it. Yeah, that'll make you mad.
And so old Pappy Koch managed to get back out of the Soviet Union before he could be given his complimentary tour of the Lubyanka prison, and thereafter became a rabid anti-communist. So when Robert Welch comes wandering around babbling things that he's hearing through the fillings in his teeth, then Koch realizes he's found his focal point.
Yeah, well, Stalin perverted communism as it was originally supposed to have developed, and that's how communism got a bad name, or for the most part, well, maybe not, maybe under Lenin, but...
Communism got a bad name from the capitalists that just wanted to fucking take it all.
Bingo. Communism got a bad name because Jason's absolutely right, because the capitalists gave it a bad name. Because I maintain that nobody understood Marx better than capitalists. And what they understood about Marx was that Marx was dead on. Absolutely correct.
Yeah, that part of it makes a lot more sense. Stalin was an evil, vicious... he couldn't kill his own people fast enough.
He was a brutal dictator. He was not a communist.
That's where the problem sets in when you... you know, a guy can turn out that way. I noticed that Giap, G-I-A-P, the guy who led the... beat the French and gave us a hard way to go. With the Vietnamese communist troops.
General Giap?
Yeah. The man's 100 years old, and he was ranking out the power structure in his own country. But, of course, they treat him good because he's a hero, and the man's 100, so, you know, screw him.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to put him up against the wall.
Yeah, and he's senile. Come on, they'll paint you a picture of a guy who's senile, you know. They do that a lot with people.
But see, therein lies the problem. The power structure that had been overthrown, Tsarist Russia, was, you know, autocratic and authoritarian.
Oh, it's terrible.
And it's all that they ever knew. So consequently, why is anybody surprised when people rise to the head of the Soviet ranks who are autocratic and authoritarian? The problem, you know, that's not a Russian problem. That's a human problem.
Yep.
And one of the things that always makes me just a little bit queasy when I hear people talking about, bring the revolution, you know, is that, you know, I have more than a passing familiarity with George Orwell's Animal Farm. And I find Animal Farm a lot more of a compelling read than 1984 myself, because it speaks a lot more to human nature. And what you see is that in the case of revolutions, almost always there are people who want the revolution to get rid of the bad guys in power because they want to be the bad guys in power.
Yep. Bob, I wanted to ask a question. You've got the Bible, which has metaphor and all kinds of figurative language, and it has a lot of abstraction and meaning to it and can be manipulated just like any kind of legal system or any kind of political ideology. How do you know when you go to a church, like there's different kinds of Christianity, like there's Dominion Christianity and there's muscular Christianity and there's this kind of Christianity.
Christian Reconstructionists.
You know, how do you know what kind of message you're getting, or how do you know how to interpret your particular brand of whatever you believe so that you're not manipulated by any, you know, right. What I'm saying? How can you be critical?
Okay, well, let me take a run at that, Larry. And, you know, Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant rabbi, talked in parables because it made it easy for people to speak, people to understand. I'm going to take a run at that. What you have just asked me, Larry, is if you've got a bottle of strychnine and a bottle of cyanide and a bottle of arsenic, how can you know which one is which without tasting them? And my answer to you is, don't taste any of them. They're all deadly poison. And
okay.
That's me. I mean, the difference.
I was going to say something right along the lines is, just don't go.
Because if I'm going to like Osteen or Tilton or somebody like that,
just stop.
And then I don't go, but I'm just wondering, you know, how. Because, you know, somebody from based upon class system, you know, somebody who's poor can justify their poverty through religion, and somebody who's rich can justify their wealth through religion. So
now I gotta offer as a sort of corollary to that, Larry. It's a corollary. Oh, I'm good tonight. Yeah, I know Bill appreciates that one.
Yes.
I'll offer as a corollary to that. That knowing enough, knowing as much as I do about your differently abled situation, Larry, I have to admit, it would be worth the price of admission to transport you down the blood red aisle of, say, a Benny Hinn, and let him get to work a healing you of your afflictions.
You wouldn't get him down the aisle, Bob. They screen those people.
Understand, Larry, I'm not making light of your physical situation.
I understand.
And of course, the real chore would be to do it and have you maintain a straight face about it all.
Yeah. I mean, I'd force myself in there and force them to try to do a faith healing on me. But I don't think that would go over too well. I'm not just talking about religion. I'm talking about political parties. I'm talking about, any success philosophies. I'm talking about psychology, psychological.
Okay. Let's take another run at
it. Bob?
Yeah.
This is Thomas.
Hey, Thomas.
I'd just like to interject, it might be, maybe I'm wrong or, but I would listen to Dr. Bill's Monday's podcast.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot to say about how religion affected our politics, and I think it might be interesting for even us all to listen to it.
Oh, that was a brilliant show.
To it again.
Yeah,
who was this, Dr. Phil?
No, Dr. Bill.
Dr. Bill.
Dr. Bill well, O'Brien Dr. on Bill. The horn.
Because Dr. And, Phil, you know, is born again.
Oh, yeah, I'm talking about Dr. Bill. He had some very interesting insights on how religion and community and all that came together and how it affects us today. And just so I thought I'd interject that.
Oh, I'm glad you did, Thomas, because it would, and it's up at White Rose, of course, under the Dr. Bill O'Brien subdomain. And you can go there and just grab the podcast, Larry. This particular past Monday, the 23rd of September, would be especially instructive on these issues. But just to go back for a second and answer your question on a broader basis, money is always a pretty good barometer. If at any point, whether it's self-help or psychological empowerment or religion or politics, if at any point in time they say to you, in order for you to participate in this, fill in the blank, religion, philosophy, whatever, we need a set amount of money from you, then you're not in a religion or a philosophy or self-help. You are you are on the carnival midway.
We're talking about large group awareness trainings, EST, the Democratic, the Republican Party, or any kind of party like that. We're talking about a religious organization. We're talking about anything that is asking me to provide a donation to them in order for me to be able to participate. Now, there are differences there because when I go down the main street where I live, I've got a lot of canvassers that are asking me for money for their particular nonprofit, whether it be ACLU or Greenpeace or any group like that. And I always say, well, I'm willing to go to my representative, or I'm willing to give you time, or I'm willing to, you know, sign a petition, but I just don't have the money to provide for you. I feel kind of guilty about that, but you know, I don't know what else to say.
But the fact of the matter is, Larry, let me contrast that with the community we've built here at the Horn. We make it a point, you know, we fundraise here. There's no getting around that, because we have to, because it's the only way we can keep going. But on the other hand, we never tell anybody that they can't participate, or they aren't welcome, or their participation is going to be somehow limited, absent their provision of money. So when you look at the ACLU person and you say, I don't have any money, but you know what, if you've got, you know, put me on your email list, and if you need me to take action that I can take, I'll take it. You know what, they'll be happy to have you take that action. And
hey,
so
Bob,
that speaks to their legitimacy. Yeah.
Hey, I got something to add to that about that. I have friends who are Mormons, and they fell on hard times. And this is a good example of what you're saying about you need to keep giving donations. And I forget exactly what happened. I think the dad had been laid off after working at, like, IBM for 30 years. And one of the Mormon bishops or hierarchy came up to him and said, hey, Brother John, we see we're lacking your donations in your charitable 10% for the last 2 months. And he tried to explain to them, cut cold turkey. They looked at him and said, until you pay up, you're no longer a member of this church.
There you go. And you have to pay memberships in other religions. I mean, I mentioned a couple of weeks back that delightful old film, Life with Father, set in 1890s oldie New York. And there's a scene where the Episcopal bishop is trying to con $10,000 out of Father to pay for a pew in the new cathedral. You know, because God didn't like the old cathedral anymore, so we got, you know how the hustle works. And him being a businessman of business and a Wall Streeter, he said, well, tell me how the value of the old pew has appreciated, Father. And of course, there's no good answer, because while they'll pray for capitalism in their churches, they don't like to be caught overtly practicing it. Hey, we've got a couple of more lights blinking here. Let's bring on the full contingent into the Friday night discussion here. Stand by. And I think we've got everybody here, and hopefully the audio will settle down. Who have we got?
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, John from D.C.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Good.
Who's on the other line?
Just listening.
Oh, there you are. Okay, hey, Jim. So we got John from D.C., Jim, Kevin, and Bill all on the traditional telephone lines and the Skype group going on the other, but I think that's at least a good benchmark, don't you, Jerry? And yeah, you're absolutely right. You have to pay your way. I guess you have to pay your own ticket to Kolob and with that bunch, don't you?
Yeah, pretty much. And it was just like that. It was just, hey, if you don't pay up, don't bother coming to church. And they were looking for, like, we're talking a couple thousand, because he made a good job. So, I mean, it was hard times, no mercy. If you don't pay, you can't participate.
Well, that sounds like what a cell phone company would do, not a church.
Well, the Mormons...
One of my favorite bunches of companies, thank you.
I mean, well, you know, when...
You forget that most religions are more capitalist than most businesses.
Well, I made the mistake, and don't forget... As I say, I don't make any mistake, I don't forget that, I realize that, but it just goes to show.
Yeah, in other words... Sorry.
With a lot of these religions, a lot of it relies on you needing someone to talk to, basically.
Okay, hold on.
I hear a voice in the background. I couldn't hear it.
Okay, John, go ahead.
Yeah. With a lot of these religions, everything you're talking about is dependent on the person needing to belong to a group. You know, none of it starts until someone says, I want to belong to a group. And as long as they can get those people who want to belong to pay the money, you know, they can tell them whatever they want, and they'll keep paying the money. You know, the thing is that whether or not you go to a church or a synagogue, if what you do during the week doesn't reflect what that organization represents or professes to, then it really doesn't matter if you go or not. You know, and that's the thing is that all yeah, go ahead. Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
I'm here.
Go ahead, Larry, if you're going to speak.
Oh, what I was going to say is that some of these religious organizations are you know, it's all profit. I mean, you just give them money, and they can decide whether or not they want to provide a social welfare service or provide, you know, help for you know, needy families if they want to. But they can just take the money and just use it for just anything. It's like a real, it's like the biggest money scam on the planet.
Look at Creflo Dollar's Learjets. Look at Joyce. What's her name?
Joyce Meyer.
Yeah. Look at her. Yeah. How many Rolls Royces does she have? Look at
about 19.
Yeah, probably. About
19.
And in fact, and then look at. Oh, what's his name? The Pastor Hagee.
Oh, God.
Kenneth Copeland. And then, of course, there's Kenneth Copeland's daughter, who was personally responsible for a minor epidemic of measles in Texas.
Oh, my God.
That was all over the news here.
I'm sorry, Jim, what?
How did she spread measles?
Because she told her congregation that God wouldn't like them if they got inoculations for their children.
Well, there's been a lot of talk against inoculations. A friend of mine adopted her grandson who's, what's the word for, he doesn't speak well, and there's an illness that's gotten bigger in time, where a kid can't talk or speak English or...
You're thinking of autism?
Autism.
Autism, yes, he's autistic.
Yeah, my grandson has that, Bill.
And there's that's all. I feel bad for him. That's a tough thing. Because I've been around my friend's grandson. He's a good kid. The problem is that a lot of these people have been saying that this is all caused by inoculations, you know, against... I'm probably one of the few guys in this room that ever had chicken pox.
Oh, no, I did, too.
You did? You got it, too, huh?
Yeah, I keep hoping one of these days to be able to afford the shingles inoculation, because now that I'm of age to worry about it, the idea of the shingles scares the hell out of me.
You are infected.
Yeah,
it hurts.
Yeah, anybody who's ever had chicken pox is a potential shingles sufferer.
I've heard the pain from that is aggravated by stress and any number of things.
Well, I'm aggravated enough by getting up in the morning, so I imagine I'll be hell on wheels with it.
Yeah, I've known people that have had shingles in my family, and that's so painful, apparently, that it will rob your will to want to keep on going. That's how painful it is, and I'm sorry to scare people.
My father had it, and it went all the way around his torso. and did permanent nerve damage. And from the time he had it in the years, and then the years remaining in his life, he always had residual pain from it that was exacerbated by the fact that he was diabetic.
Oh, boy.
Speaking of nasty things, has anyone heard of the new super drug crocodile?
Yeah, I've seen a couple of stories about that, Jeremy, and that is that flesh-eating narcotic?
Yeah, it literally, they say from the time you start to the time you die will be 3 years. It eats you from the inside out. It's a mixture of regular drugs like metamorphines and then hydrocarbons, so diesel, gas, and kerosene.
And it came from Russia, did it? Did I read that right?
It originated, yeah, there's a ton of addicts in Russia. It's a hardcore thing there. It's their meth.
Jesus.
Well, don't forget the brain-eating amoeba.
Oh, there's
lots of... one literally makes you...
Easy now with the communist comment now. Russia's no longer communist. They're getting close to as capitalists or more capitalist than what we are.
Yeah, I was just making the usual right-wing remark about how right-wingers will handle this kind of stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah, that was what I... Of course.
Sarcasm is my middle name. I can't help it.
No worries.
Well, Bob, you conjured me when you started talking about Joseph Stalin.
Oh, okay. Duncan, you were saying something?
I took a hit for the team last night, and I watched Oxyana.
Oh, did you? Yeah, I saw where you said you were doing your homework assignment.
I posted a link on the Horn Facebook page and on your page.
What did you think?
Utter desperation.
Was there any reference to maybe there being a sort of environmental or cultural component to it all? Or was it all just sort of...
Well, the cultural component is just no work. There's nothing to do. They talked about, well, you have to drive half an hour to go to a movie theater, and their big thing was to go out in the woods and run around on four-wheelers and have bonfires and drink beer and do that. I guess the what was that?
What are you talking about?
Documentary that Isaac had told us about that I referenced on the program last night called Oxyana, which is a documentary about the OxyContin prescription narcotics problem in a little town called Oceana in a southern West Virginia county.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a militia meeting.
With the
four wheelers and the running around in the woods.
Oh no. That's just recreation around here.
Yeah, that's typical country life.
I mean, that's how that kid what was the name of that MTV program? Buck Wild.
That's what I was trying to think of.
That's how that kid wound up dead. You know, 3 o'clock in a bar. We're gonna go four wheeling and flat tracking out in the woods, and the car broke down or got stuck up to the hubs in mud, and they asphyxiated themselves with exhaust fumes.
Oh, Bob, yeah. That was such great entertainment, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
It's just amazing what people can do when they want to make a dump truck into a swimming pool or jump into a river that you can see the atomic plant right up.
No, that was the John Amos power plant, Jim. That's not nuclear.
Oh, well.
That's one of our nastier coal-fired power plants. A lot of that particulate matter runs right up the Kanawha Valley, and, well, we get to breathe it here.
Well, there were just some wonderful people in that. I'm glad they took that thing off the air because it was just ridiculous. Absolutely just stupid. I mean, it's just an exhibition of so many other things you see on television today about people behaving badly. I mean, you know, there's one program called Pawn Star.
Yeah.
Which is fun. I love that.
Okay. I'm glad you said that because that I admit a guilty pleasure of occasionally watching an episode of Pawn Stars.
Yeah, I enjoy that. But then there's another one that comes out of Detroit, Michigan. And basically,
that's horrible, Jim.
Basically, what it is all these people who come into the pawn shop who don't have their tickets or who are street people or who are One guy came in with an invisible friend, and he was talking to the invisible friend, and there was an it's just a series of arguments between the pawn store owner, Seth Gold. I mean, not Seth Gold, but Les Gold, and then there's the son named Seth Gold, and then there's Ashley. And it's nothing more but a bitch fight between... It's just one great big collective bitch fight in the whole thing. It's called
hardcore. That's what most of this stuff. Even if you look on like network news, that's what most of it devolves into. I mean, you look on Fox News or just Jersey Shore. It may not, you know, all of it devolves into one big argument where a bunch of idiots get on TV and for some reason they were allowed on the show, and then they eventually just start arguing. You know, and that's what happens on the news to, you know, Fox News. I mean, even you know, CNN, when they got the commentators talking to each other, eventually it just
became MSNBC.
Yeah.
I mean, I've gotten to the point where I have very little interest in watching MSNBC anymore. I mean, I kind
of almost to the point that I don't anymore.
Yeah, I mean, okay, this is the part where you get to, like, you know, really, really verbally abuse me. I watch more in MSNBC. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Because at least there's some entertainment value there.
Well, you can get good and aggravated and get your day started, Bob, watching that bunch, yeah.
I mean, as a kid, I loved to go to the carnival. As a child, I loved to go to the circus and the fair. And it's the same impulse that makes me watch Morning Joe. I mean, it's hucksterism. And
how does Mika put up with Joe? That's the real question.
I don't either. I can't stand that man.
Oh, he's atrocious. But he doesn't. But it's not like there's somebody counterbalancing him. What, Donnie Deutsch is? Please.
Joe's actually an old school Republican.
Yeah.
He's not. He's not like these freaking wacky teabag pieces of human excrement that we have to deal with in Congress now.
Isn't Melissa Harris Perry or Chris Hayes still on the MSNBC and Saturday mornings or whatever?
Well, Chris Hayes has his
big
own
time.
Yeah, Chris Hayes hit the big time. He's got a 5-day-a-week show.
Yeah, he went to 7 o'clock.
And they brought.
I'm gonna drop off. Somebody else can call in.
Okay, Kevin, good hearing from you. Have a good weekend.
Yep,
okay, Kevin.
Have a good weekend, and I'll give you a call tomorrow, Bob. No deal.
Bye, Kevin.
Okay, see you, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
Bye, Kevin. Goodbye.
And hopefully someone else will call in since I'm dropping off, because I'd like to hear, you know, some of the newer people and newer callers. So call in.
Okay, good deal. See you, Kevin.
What was that show you were talking about that you couldn't stand, that you don't watch anymore? One of the callers was saying... What was it? Oh, I didn't hear. I'm sorry.
What, the pawn show?
It was something about, we were talking about Oxiana, and then there was a show that you were talking about that was on, that had all kinds of crazy stuff on it that...
Buckwild.
Buckwild.
Yeah, that show went away when one of its principal stars stupided himself to death.
Oh, boy. That's like Thrillbilly's... Cubed, huh? Okay.
One of the Darwin Awards.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Early in the program, they turned a dump truck. Jim wasn't kidding. They turned a dump truck into a swimming pool, and then later on, he turned his Ford Bronco into a gas chamber.
Well, you know why they do this? They do this because you know it's like a sports. By the way, I don't know what happened in that West Virginia Maryland game.
It was awful. Not another word, Larry. Not another word.
Okay. All right.
We got Oklahoma State tomorrow, and you know I'm stockpiling meds.
Okay. By the way, the reason why they do these shows like this is that they found out that it's, you know, like doing a sports show. It's a lot cheaper in terms of production.
Yep.
For them to do some silly show like this, you know, or do some reality show, than it is for them to hire some actors and put together a crew and do a soap opera, you know, or do a syndicated That's why they do it. You know?
Not to mention, Larry, they're basically cutting out the mostly unionized screenwriters.
Bingo.
That's exactly right.
And there's one more thing that underlies all of that, and I forget where I read it, maybe Alternet or somewhere like that. But there's an argument to be made that these shows, whether it be The Turtle Man from Kentucky or Pawn Stars, not so much Pawn Stars, because, I mean, there are people who aren't just coming in desperate off the streets. I mean,
Lord, they had George Stephanopoulos come in yesterday and buy a first edition of For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Yeah, so I exempt Pawn Stars from that. But these things that, you know, Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child.
Oh, God.
And Toddlers and Tiaras.
Oh, geez.
But in particular, things like Honey Boo Boo Child and the Duke Dynasty, and which I've never seen and don't even understand. Apparently, it features ZZ Top.
Oh, my God. Bob, let me ask you something.
Let me finish the idea, Jim. And that is this. There is something taking place in these so-called reality programs that smacks of the normalization of poverty, and it's a way for the wealth class in this country to tell everybody else, see, it's okay to be poor and ignorant.
Society, our culture basically promotes that. We kind of denigrate people who actually want to be intellectual and lift up people like, you know, celebrities, sports stars, people that really have nothing to add to a conversation, but they're popular because they're big, dumb, and stupid. I don't think we really celebrate. I mean, if you look at the percentage of people who have access to education and the percentage of people who actually utilize it and do something with it, you know, the ratio there is, the difference is massive. So it's not like as a society we celebrate intellectualism.
Gentlemen, let me ask you something. I don't know if you've ever heard this program. It started back in the 90s, and it's back when reality TV got its footing with MTV. And it basically dealt with young people living together in the real world.
Yeah.
And I can remember the first program they had was really great. It had the boys who had AIDS, Pedro Zamora, and then, you know, it brought in other things and how they got to live with one another and accept, you know, the HIV of this wonderful Mexican boy who's long since left the world, and also his boyfriend or his husband or Sean Sasser, who lived in D.C., died recently. But nonetheless, the real world, now that was a good program. And I enjoyed it. And then you had, I guess, a number of things that sprung from that that were much less educational and basically...
Right, and devolves all the way down to the Jersey Shore.
And basically, confrontational. It went from educational to confrontational. That's what it is.
Yeah, but the educational part of Real World lasted like only like one or two seasons. After that, I mean, they had Real World 1, 2, 3. They had Real World... Chicago, Real World, Japan. I mean,
They went all over.
Right, that whole intellectual thing, that lasted maybe like one or two seasons, like at the most. I mean, and then it was just, you know, okay, Real World, strippers and Spring Break.
At least it had a good start, and some of the episodes were of social redeeming value, and as it went on down the pike, it did leave something to be desired. But
right, Jim, and the reason it devolved the way it did is those episodes that had socially redeeming value probably had the lowest rating shares of any of their episodes, and the episodes that had two girls pulling each other's hair, the numbers went through the roof. So guess which way the marketers the skew.
Yeah, definitely. You know,
one thing in here.
Can I interject something? Since Bob just said that.
Yeah, jump in, Duncan.
This weekend is a historic moment. The last episode of Breaking Bad is on Sunday night.
Uh-huh.
And AMC is charging their largest 30-second advertising rates in the history of the network.
Oh, my God.
For that 1 hour and 15-minute show.
I have a confession to make, Duncan.
Yeah.
I have never seen a single episode of Breaking Bad.
Nor have I.
Right now there's a Breaking Bad marathon going on AMC.
It's hilarious, man. It's hilarious.
You know, Bob, how is it that you've got a teacher in a classroom and they want to use some historical program that California Newsreel or PBS, and I shouldn't really mention names, but generally PBS, and he or she wants to use it to teach students, and the community college district or the state university system or whatever can't afford the fee to be able to buy the program, so they're going to restrict access to the use of that educational piece of information and keep people from seeing it or keep people from using it if they can't pay whatever it is that PBS wants for it. You know, that's really disgusting to me. I mean, I understand copyright and all that, but it's really disgusting.
Well, PBS ain't PBS anymore.
Yeah, and it is certainly not for the public benefit.
No.
I mean, PBS is a corporation just like any other.
But there are a lot of good things on PBS. I mean, particularly on Sunday nights and things of that nature. And
sure there are.
Excellent programs. They really do.
Yeah, there's excellent programming there. I mean, I love Nova up till the point where they say Nova is brought to you by Charles and David Koch.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, they have to pay. And, you know, what really bothers me a lot about PBS, at least locally here, are when they have some of these fundraising drives. And they have these people who get on there, and they're all taped. And if you call in, it's to somewhere in Tennessee or something like that. But basically, they get on there, and you'll have one guy say one thing, and one girl say another thing, and they all are so, you know, damn repetitive. You just want to switch the thing off.
Well, and here in West Virginia, you know, Jim, you're absolutely right. There's some brilliant programming on PBS. But,
oh, I love that station.
But you know what? You ever turned it on in the early evening of Saturday or Sunday? And you get back-to-back-to-back-to-back episodes of Red Green or back-to-back-to-back-to-back episodes of Lawrence Welk?
Well, I mean, for an older generation who likes Lawrence Welk and who enjoys that music and type, I can understand that. I mean, Lawrence Welk's been on that program for a long time. Guy's been dead a long time, but nonetheless, you know, that doesn't bother me because I can just flip it. But I mean, for example, last year when they had Dawson Abbey and some of the other programs,
oh my God.
It was just an
what is up with Downtown Abbey? Who watches that? I don't even know how that became a TV show. It's like watching, you know, a soap opera meets Mary Poppins. What is
No, I disagree. I'm Upstairs, Downstairs. It's an incredibly accurate, in my opinion, definition of English historical society before and after the Great War, and you see the social changes that happened, and also why people left service and this, that, and the other. And
check it out some more then.
I think you should, because it's, and also, there's an element of beauty to the, people who are able to really photograph or film these things. I mean, absolutely superb.
Well, by the way, we've had a note in from, Robert in Australia. Robert up in Australia, I should note.
Mm-hmm.
Subject line, Junk TV. He says, since we got digital TV here in Australia and the networks were allowed to multi-channel, they've had to find content to fill the void.
Yeah.
So what do? They buy the cheapest crap they can from the U.S., so we have been subject to all the shows you've been discussing, and people wonder why I've stopped watching broadcast TV.
Have you ever heard of a series of programs called The Line of Beauty?
Hold on, Jason.
Well, I've tried several times to get in here. We got a long ways away from reality shows now, but I just wanted to interject my favorite one, which is Gator Boys on Animal Planet. You guys seen that one?
Yeah.
No, I won't watch that.
And I've seen Swamp People.
No,
too.
Gator Boys is different than Swamp People.
Oh,
Boys is where they go out and rescue nuisance alligators down here in South Florida. They get the calls from the Florida Wildlife Commission,
and they
get them, and they catch them by hand. And it's really amusing.
You know, Bob, I'd love to be able to get, I don't know if this is appropriate, but I'm going to say it. I really enjoy talking with everybody on the chat. I really enjoy talking with people that call in on the phone, but people like, you know, Jim and various other people, I'd love to be able to keep in touch with you all, but I don't know how to do it, you know, in a way that's going to be discreet if you don't join the Skype chat. But I really enjoy having all the people call in because I learn a lot from all of you.
Yeah, my computer won't work with Skype.
Well, same here. Absolutely.
Thank you, Larry. That's very kind of you to say. Note coming in from Juanita in Ohio. She says, I'd say that Pawn Stars are somewhat educational. But, you know, it's fake. After all, who brings historic relics to a pawn shop? If you have a Civil War cannon, I don't think a pawn shop is where you want to go. And she says, I think Pickers is another fake one. And I, you know, yeah, there's...
I mean, that's sort of strange.
But you know, there's a line to be, there's kind of a dot-to-dot line to be drawn. It's Pickers, isn't it, where they go through people's junk barns and old bicycle parts and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. It's incredible the amount of money, for example, for an Indian motorcycle, 1930s vintage. Of what they could do was just a chassis and just a cylinder head. I got
to wondering, Jim, about the, where's the market for this? And then I thought about the last time that I sat in a Cracker Barrel restaurant. You know, and there are other restaurants the same way. There's all this old kitsch, old signage, rusty,
exactly,
old license plates. In fact, I owe John Fox a license plate. He's making a tech box. He told me some time back, and I need to get that to him. I've got the old license plate I had on my Porsche back when I had a Porsche, and it just says Schnell. Well, my buddy said Achtung, so you know.
Well, I can think of worse things you could have put on there. But I knew one guy who had Let's put on his.
Well, my favorite personalized license plate was the woman who had a Porsche, and her vanity plate simply read "Was His."
Well, I saw one a couple of years ago that it really was OICU812.
Yeah, that's a variation on the old Led Zeppelin album title OU812.
Is that it?
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
But between that and Let's and let's see, if, I don't know.
I didn't think it was Led Zeppelin.
No, OU812. Did I say Led Zeppelin? I thought I said Van Halen.
Yeah, there you go, Led Van
Zeppelin.
Halen.
OICU812.
Oh, but Jason, I was going to mention to you. You said you're talking about Gator Boys. Well, the other one that's out there, and I'm not sure if it's still in active production, but you can catch reruns from time to time. Is the Turtle Man, and that's just an adventure in I guess hillbilly. But what you've got is this guy who has a knack for finding critters, and he personally picks them up and removes them from situations, but in a very, very caring way. I saw an episode one night where he was
redeeming.
Yeah, where he was capturing possums and raccoons off of a houseboat on a Kentucky lake.
Well, I like on Gator Boys, man. Sometimes they'll get an alligator in somebody's swimming pool, and the guy Paul, he'll just go in there in the water with the gator, and pretty much drag him out over his shoulders.
I tell you,
hunting them in the water with the little catch pole and all and everything, and he pulls them out. And, you know, of course the gator's thrashing around and everything, but they don't ever hurt them. And then they relocate them and stuff like that.
That's really good. That's a good thing, too. You know, just as an aside here, and I got to get off here, I can remember we had just tons of squirrels in my backyard at home. And, you know, a lot of people, you could hear shots of being fired, people killing them.
Mm-hmm.
And what my dad would do, he would put traps for them, and he would trap a bunch of squirrels, and he would take them down to Quaker Cemetery and let them out. And, you know, he said, well, you know, I think some of those people need some company, too.
Hear, hear. Absolutely. And not a lot of hunting inside the cemetery, I imagine, Jim.
Absolutely. And, I mean, that's what he would do. I mean, he had a special trap, and he was, you know, he always... My father never hurt anybody or hurt anything like that as far as... I inherited my love for animals and things like that from him. He was a good man. And you know, and he did that once a week. And, you know, I guess that now that he's there in Quaker Cemetery, that maybe some of those people or those critters are keeping him company, too. I would like to think of that.
Yeah, the squirrels he trapped, great-great-great-great-great-great-grand squirrels.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, why would anybody would want to get out and just, for the hell of it, shoot an animal?
Well, now wait, Jim, that's not for the hell of it. There's a whole lot of folks out there that think squirrel gravy is about as good eaten as you're likely to find on planet Earth.
Well, that's disgusting.
Don't knock it till you've had it, John.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, people got to get their food from somewhere, especially when you're not living in an ideal environment where you can afford to just go get your food.
And there are old-timers around here who would crawl across ground glass for squirrel brains.
Oh my God.
Hey, can you imagine? Don't you dare say
a little bit too far.
Yeah, listen, there's one more thing I want to ask you about, and it's another reality show where this guy has built a castle with
battles. Doomsday Castle.
What's it called?
Doomsday Castle. It's on Nat Geo.
And then he teaches his children. This guy is very much ex-military. And he teaches his kids they're in their 20s, and they go out and they absolutely set some of these traps like swinging logs with rebar in them, the kind of stuff they used to see in Vietnam.
So he's preparing for the apocalypse.
Where they got people getting ready for the apocalypse, isn't there? Isn't there one with their preppers or something like that?
Yeah, there's that too. Hey guys, we got to knock it off because we're right on top of the time. Sure flies when you're having fun. Jim and Bill and John, everybody on the traditional phone lines, thank you very much. Have yourself a good weekend. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, good night, y'all.
Thank you. Good night. Have a nice weekend.
And Duncan, I presume that the conversation will continue on. We'll continue on Skype and pick up again after Malloy at about 12:05 Eastern time.
It will be active after you closed out the show, Bob.
All right, awesome. Thanks for moderating, Duncan. You do as ever a magnificent job. Thanks, Skype gang, for chiming in and sharing in the conversation. Sure makes the front porch a heck of a lot more fun. Y'all have a good weekend. And there goes another Friday on the front porch. We'll do this again next Friday. I get a heck of a kick out of it. I think it's a lot of fun. Thanks very much, everybody, who has made this a week to remember, a week in which we found a way, y'all found a way, to keep the horn going. Thank you very much. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room, and thanks to Sparky again for moderating the Horn Malloy Scant group. Skype group, and thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox and to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. Go there, AICACT.org, to learn how to be a part of ending Appalachia's agony. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.